Hey everyone. So as you know, throughout the month of June here on the Queer Quadrant, we are highlighting different LGBTQ plus orgs that we're fans of, that we recommend donating to, and that we will also be donating to during this month. So this week we are talking about the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, which works for transgender equal rights. It is a national organization and it was founded all the way back in 2003. They obviously want to end discrimination and achieve equality, but also have a lot of opportunities for donation and strategies to actionably help trans people all across the country. So some of the work that they do is the Name Change Project, which connects low-income trans and non-binary people with pro bono attorneys to assist with legal name changes. They also do a lot of work in impact litigation, as well as public education to provide education on transgender rights in schools, and also have the Trans Health Project, which expands access to transgender-related healthcare. So we will be donating. They accept donations through their website. We will link all of their info in our bio for this episode, but you can find them at transgenderlegal.org and on Twitter and Facebook as well. They are on Twitter at TLDEF. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
I would like to take down and lead a revolution against the government that we've established so far in this podcast. It's been... I would say, you know, between the two of us and some guests, it's felt a little bit like a democracy. I would like to make it a bureaucracy.
There it is. There it is.
How do we feel about that?
I was really going to see how long it would take you to drop in that this is not a democracy. It's a bureaucracy.
I can keep holding on it longer if we want.
It's too late now.
Like bad political allegories. How do we feel?
No, it's great. I mean, like, okay, so that line implies it's not a democracy, you know, it's a fascist system because she's being a cheer-tater, according to Whitney and that other girl whose name I already forget.
Right. Courtney, I believe. It's gotta be a Courtney.
Courtney and Whitney.
These are millennials. It's a Courtney.
I was gonna say, all of these names, okay, just full disclosure, apologies to listeners and to you, Jordan, myself, the other Jordan. I watched this for the first time. And
can you believe
first time in my life, but I grew up with Stick It,
it's the superior Jessica Bendinger.
Okay, great, thank you.
No question.
Okay, I wanted just to get it out of the way that now having experienced both, maybe it's because I grew up with Stick It, but if you compare the two of these, Stick It is a superior movie.
Yes.
I grew up with both, and my heart resides with Stick It. Bring It On is unimpeachable, but I think what Jessica Bendinger does in Bring It On is actually more fully honed and realized in Stick It.
And
it's like the B tier to the A list of Bring It On, but I think actually the B tier is the most native home for the colloquialisms and the sort of queer sensibility.
Oh, for sure.
Is it can more fully embrace the camp, I think, at that level. Yeah. Having fucking Jeff Bridges as a gymnastics coach is
wild.
I mean,
bizarre.
One of the most insane castings in history.
Unheard of. without precedent and without repeat.
We'll never ever be an equal. It's just one of the most bizarre pieces of casting. Every time you go back to the movie, it's always astounding when he shows up in a tracksuit and you're like, right, Jeff Bridges
is
in this.
Fucking Bridges. I choose to believe that in his heart he accepted the Oscar for Stick It. You know, like,
as far as what is a more out of expectation turn that is like a stretch of one's range for Jeff Bridges, Stick It is absolutely the one that demonstrates what this man is capable of. And also, I think what we get, love Torrance, love Kirsten Dunst, of course. But this movie, for me, is Missy. Yes. Excuse me, is the Les Dushku. Please. And so what we get from Bring It On is the... What we get in Bring It On is getting to see Missy basically as the heroine. Like, in the form of actual fucking Missy Peregrine as Haley.
I was just going to say, a lot of Missy's going around. We are definitely not Missy-ing a Missy. We're not Missy-ing
Get ready for a lot of this. Okay, wait.
I mean, it's in step with the vocab of the parlance of this episode.
It's Should we only speak in bad puns?
I think so,
Every
yes.
sentence needs one bad pun no matter what.
Oh, I'll leave it to you guys because that's not my specialty.
I was going
to
say, that's not my specialty, but it won't be a problem.
I will
for
try my hardest.
But we're not saying the quality is like it's quantity over quality. Maybe.
I will cheer my. Nope.
He choked at the 1 yard line. Okay.
I was doing a flip midair, and the guy who was supposed to catch me just like pulled his arms out, and I just crashed and broke all my legs.
And you went down like Carver.
Poor Carver. I'm gonna need like. It's so hard to remember all the names of all these white girls. Because they all blend together.
That's legitimate.
Other than Torrance, because I was like, insane name.
Torrance Shipman.
Right, Torrance Shipman is an elite name. That's an elite name.
I feel like she could fit in the French Connection. Just like you have like Popeye and like Torrance, and they're just like two like kind of grungy PIs on the case. You know, like that makes sense, you know?
I love it as such a choice in the way that like Tree... is such a choice in Happy Death Day. Like, her name is Lisa, but, like, Tree. Like, you don't forget that. That logs in there. That has a special, like, prominence in the archives, in the Mind Palace.
Are you saying that the name Tree logs in there?
I suppose I am.
I don't know if I can actually handle this.
That was pretty good.
That was pretty good. I actually still don't know if I can handle this. Okay, wait. Before we go any further.
Where are we going?
Right. Down the disembodied voice is?
We are so pleased to welcome to the podcast today, Jordan Cruciola, writer, producer, podcaster extraordinaire, number one Jennifer's Body stan.
Thank you so much for
2000s
confirming.
Movie expert. Seriously, it is such a pleasure to have you here to talk about this movie.
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me. Thank you so much.
A pleasure to have you.
Yeah, let's
I'm glad you took that opportunity.
That's what I will throw in some, you know, cheers as we go.
Mm-hmm. Some sprinkling, some sauce. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and as for the other two disembodied voices, I am Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson.
And we are just two soon-to-be cheerleaders that love talking about movies, talking about being queer, talking about queer movies, and here we are talking about them on mic.
And we're about to bring it on.
Cheering intermittently. We are definitely going to bring it on.
I mean, it's already been brought in, so.
Oh, no.
No.
It's a Jordan squared episode. You guys are not going to have a problem because whenever you say Jordan, you'll just be talking about the other one. I, on the other hand, I'm going to need to figure out some way to differentiate this. I haven't figured it out yet, but we'll come up with something.
You can call me. I'll go by Torrance if we want this app.
Okay, cool.
No,
Big Red, maybe.
No.
But then we're going to be talking about Torrance, too.
That's true. Mm.
Oh, don't worry. This is my cross to bear. I'll figure it out.
I think we call... You know what?
Well, you know, a common handle and the Twitter... Jor Crew is actually... has been a known nickname at points if you wanted to vault to Jor Crew.
Look at
it's
that.
A good nickname, let
Jor
me tell
Crew,
you.
J Crew, both
oh,
totally acceptable.
Are we going shopping?
With a, you know, yeah, with CRU, it's my proprietary take on it.
I love
TM,
it. I love it.
CRU.
Right, you can copyright that shit, no problem.
Right,
you
yeah.
should
and
right
should.
Now.
Yeah, you
the,
should.
The website, domain, do you have it? Because get it. okay, since we're here and we're talking about Bring It On, we just need to get it out of the way because we're talking about names. And you know what are similar to names?
Titles.
And you know what franchise has absolutely bananas titles?
Bring It On, Cinematic Universe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Can you, Brooke or Jordan, do you know any of the other titles?
I think I know most of them.
Okay, go.
I think the only one I could tell you off the top of my head is In It to Win It.
Yes.
Yes. You were in it to win it and you got it.
So, what was... Right, but it sounds like Brooke's gonna take this one.
Hopefully. So what was the first sequel?
So the first sequel is Bring It On Again.
Absolutely. Again? Oh, right. We brought it.
Like, thank you for not calling it Bring It On 2. Okay. Mm-hmm. We love creativity. And I don't remember what order they come in. But
no, I have the order here.
I do believe after Bring It On Again, it's Bring It On All or Nothing.
I love absolutely. That.
Which is you kind got of it. Like,
you
is
got
that
it.
The Hayden Panettiere one?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
With,
yes. Yeah.
With Solange. None other than Solange Knowles herself, which is like the other kind of good one, but like not that good. Mm. And also not that important.
Is Hayden Panettiere a good actress?
But see, I feel like, okay, look, between this and Scream 4,
Hayden Panettiere always does what she needs to do. Hayden Panettiere always does what the job demands.
Yeah.
Mm. She did it in Heroes.
That's what I was
going to
say.
She did it in Bring It On. She defined the essence of Hayden Panettiere in Scream 4.
Yes.
As
yes.
Kirby. I've never been let down by Hayden Panettiere. And
that's
I think
the
that's
thing.
A good,
she delivers.
I feel like that's a good take.
Yeah. Nor have I by her single that came out like near the same time as Stars Are Blind. Yes. That had the music video that co-starred Sebastian Stan. That's all about like cheating on your man because he cheated on you.
And it was like the Seb Stan
Island. It has like that tropical
era.
Beat.
Yeah.
This is a very hashtag girl boss thing to say.
Mutual cheating?
Mutual cheating, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, we love a toxic relationship. I mean, yes, look, Hayden Panettiere. The thing is, I feel like she's very good in sequels because no disrespect to her, love her, but you don't necessarily want
to entrust a franchise to her
as your first choice. But she's a great. Like, she's a great pinch hitter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You
bring Hayden, her in, she picks Hayden it up. I think Hayden has never got her first film chance.
Didn't she have,
level.
Like, a show, though? Like, wasn't she on Nashville or something like that?
She was the star of Nashville. Yeah, I mean, was the star of season one of Heroes. Like, Save the Cheerleader, Save the World was, like, the log line of that first season.
That show puttered out real quick.
It went for like five or six seasons. I only watched the last two seasons. Loved it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I know this is even after the show has apparently gotten bad. I love this.
I was only on board for the first two. So,
yeah,
if you watch three, then we'll have seen it all.
We'll be a Heroes expert.
God.
Yeah.
Well, Captain Planet this shit.
We'll have a Heroes podcast.
Absolutely. Heroes cast coming to you 2022.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
You were in it to win it.
So after
that, are we at?
So Bring It On Again, Bring It On All or Nothing, Bring It On In It to Win
It. In
It
to Win It.
Bring It On Fight to the Finish.
Yes.
And then there's another one.
There's two more.
Wow. There's another one that's like called Bring It On Cheer World or something
close,
like that. What's,
close.
What is it?
Bring It On Worldwide Cheer Smack.
Cheer
Whoa.
Smack?
Yeah, baby.
Whoa.
Cheer Smack.
I wish I could see the titles that didn't get picked for that one.
There was none. They combined them all into one. They were like, okay, Worldwide.
Smack.
Okay, good idea. What if Cheer Smack? And they were like, fuck. You know what? Why not Worldwide Cheer Smack? I love them both.
There had to be alts to Cheer Smack that were like other collections of verbs.
Cheer
like
hack.
There had to be just
cheer off. Cheer
right. Like yeah. Like
cheer down.
Talk. Cheer down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like
we're having a cheer talk
there.
Right now.
Yeah. There were so many options.
I know.
Yeah. So many.
But then there's one more.
And
there's
one more.
Mm-hmm. Coming in 2022 to Sci-Fi Channel
Bring It On Halloween.
That's
written by internet queen Dana Schwartz.
Wild.
I'm honestly stoked for it.
It has the potential to be the best sequel.
Yes.
Like it's highly likely this could walk away with the best Bring It On sequel mantle.
You had mentioned Happy Death Day, and I would love if you just had a Happy Death Day vibe to Bring It On. Like, that would be a delight.
We're having some really incredible, like, teen horror renaissance business the last couple of years between Happy Death Day and Freaky and sort of, like, the
basically the Chris Landon cinematic style.
Yes. Like, it's very nice.
We love a white man who can somehow tap into teenage women's lives in a beautiful way.
Who's more of a teen girl in this world than adult gay men, white gay men? Like, that's they are.
But then also, like, this movie directed by a straight white man,
Peyton Reed.
The fact that, I mean, Peyton Reed really, and he loves this movie. He's like proud of the legacy of Bring It On. And
he should be.
It really tells me it's very vulnerable to stan a cis white straight man in Hollywood.
It really
you
is.
Just never know. But like what it tells me, what he was able to accomplish as this movie is that like he's one of the good ones. Like,
and
wow.
He also did Down With Love.
I was going to say, let's look at the material. Right. Like, mm-hmm. Down With Love is an all-time fucking classic. We all know that, like, we should have seen his Fantastic Four take.
Absolutely.
Right. Oh, absolutely true.
All of that behind the
and
scenes
the fact that
happened.
He didn't now get it. He did those two Ant-Mans, and you're like, oh, he's got his Marvel blank check. Here he goes to make Fantastic Four. And they're like, John Watts, here you go. And you're like, no.
No, we don't want that. And I mean, the Ant-Mans are dear to me. What a fun. I love the Marvel movies. And the Ant-Mans are just so delightful. And like, yeah, it just, he's got like all the way back in 1999. He was like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna see through this, like, I'm gonna channel the writings of this woman, and I am going to not tamp down the, like, queer extra sensibility of what's happening in this movie, and I'm gonna indeed, like, understand it enough to give it such a capable directorial hand. Like, this is somebody who, it feels like the screenwriter and director working together really understood this material. And we simply cannot trust men in that way. So I'm very impressed.
And to then go back to and be like, you know, I know that there was like a lot of like baked in homophobia and it was like a part of the time. And
the
2000s
are wild.
For that.
Truly
right.
Wild.
But like, if you look at like where this was, I don't think, I mean, this movie has a lot of flaws in terms of like certain like fat shaming and using a lot of like problematic words.
Oh, we'll get
it. It really feels like I mean honestly, more than any other aspect of it, the thing that hits me sharpest is the fat shaming.
I totally agree.
Like, it's not even it, like, this movie loves a gay gag, but and they're
oh it loves
like
them.
It's like all of the Bring It On movies have a very interesting relationship with race.
Yeah.
But it's the fat shaming is like, holy fucking shit, we're not stopping.
Yeah.
Like, this entire movie throughout is going to be like, fuck you fatties. Like, the entire time, it's really just like, shit.
It's nuts. And it's like,
whoa!
It could have stood like a self-aware pass to be like, we understand that this is the culture, but we're not glorifying it. But I feel like it does. It so easily falls into that early 2000s camp of like, it's so funny, right? We don't condone it. And it's like, I mean, you condone it a little bit.
It's like, you know, I wonder, I think about the 2000s with its sort of, there was almost like this South Parkification of our humor at the time, which was, I mean, that's when that show was really climbing to its zenith. And it stood out. Its whole thing was everybody's a target.
Yeah.
Everybody's a target. And everybody really was a target on that show. And it's such a melange of a time. In what is this, 1999 or 2000?
99.
Yeah.
99.
Like, where we have like...
Oh, wait, yeah. No, 2000. This is 2000. Sorry.
2000. Okay. Yeah. We have the ascendancy of Kevin Williamson in horror, who has really he's redefined the genre with Scream. And he has imbued in it a queer sense of humor and a queer eye. And a queer sort of attitude in a way that we hadn't seen kind of ever, but it, you know, in the way horror's always been queer. Like, there was James Whale back in the 30s.
Exactly.
There was such a queer strain through his work. Like, but in the way that it was so self-aware.
Yeah.
And it was becoming like, we were saturated by media in a different way as we're getting into the 2000s. There's just so much more of everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so you have like Kevin Williamson, who has changed the tone of genre. And along with Kevin Williamson, up and coming at the time, you have Don Mancini, who had created the Chucky franchise in like the first movie, I think, came out in 1988. But then like in the 90s, we get Bride of Chucky, which is like a much more overtly queer strain of that franchise. franchise, which is going to lead into Seed of Chucky, which is super fucking queer in the mid-2000s.
Yes.
So, like, Don Mancini, always been gay, but the voice of him as a gay creator is starting to emerge more overtly in his work at that time. And then you have Darren Stein, who's made Jawbreaker, which is just, like... It's the continuation in the spirit of, you know, Heathers.
Exactly. And it wants to be Heathers so bad.
Yeah. Well, and to me, Jawbreaker is my Heathers. Like, I love Heathers, right. But Jawbreaker's the one for me. And Fern Mayo is absolutely a queer avatar in that movie. She's a queer fucking character. And then you have Courtney Shane existing in that tradition of, like, bad bitch queer icons played yes. by, like... cis white women that are you know a storied part of queer canon and in cinema history.
Them.
Yeah, and then you have Silvio Horta, you know, God rest his soul. You have Silvio Horta wrote Urban Legend, and so you have this like this coterie of gay creators who are setting the teen movie sensibility for the era. They're resetting it, and from that, and also at this time, you have. Progress, like we're getting, it's the new millennium, it's almost it's the 21st century,
yeah,
but progress is running up alongside the institutionalized fucking homophobia and bigotry that's always been there. And so you're having a climate where Will and Grace comes into existence,
exactly.
where like the gay best yes. friend lives next door and he's cool and we accept him, but at the same time this gay sensibility is pushing its way through into cinema, where then it starts getting almost kind of appropriated by straight filmmakers who
yes.
are like, hey guys, we say fag now, right? Like, we're all in on the joke together so we can joke about everything. It's almost like, hey guys, we beat it. We did it. We beat homophobia so we can just like say homophobic shit, right? And like racism,
yes.
we're not going to deal with that yet. That's a few years down the road. And like fat shaming, fat phobia, that is definitely like the aesthetic pressure of the 2000s and peak paparazzi culture is a fucking nightmare for the beauty industrial complex and the millennial people who grew up with it, who absorbed that shit.
I don't even want to.
What norms should be.
Yeah.
So it is such a cacophonous time.
Yes.
Of pop culture and messaging and progress meets regressiveness. And it's just, it's the most interesting era of movies to talk about to me. And
yeah,
yes,
no,
it's
guaranteed.
What I grew up with. It's my native stuff. But like,
same.
The recency, we have so much to unpack from history with so many texts and pieces of analysis and readings. We are just now arriving at a place where we are processing the 2000s and the new millennium. It feels so far away and yet so close, and we are sort of in the process now of making the analytical texts of what that time was and what it meant. So it all, it's very, ooh, it's fascinating.
I love talking about the 2000s too, because like, in terms of sort of the, like you said, the aesthetics and like the cultural shift of what you have to reckon with at this time, like it's a very like trashy mainstream like look. And so I think like looking at it through a critical lens is so interesting, because it's like not only do you have to deal with all of the regular critical like film and television and media shit that you have
yeah.
to deal with, you also have to be like, I know this movie looks deep fried and like everyone has their midriffs hanging out and like is talking about like the most vapid shit ever, but like you have to understand this is like culture, this is the moment, like this is iconic, this is like, you know, shaping a generation of people. Like it feels like so many movies around this time were intent on telling the audience, we are not serious, you don't have mm-hmm. to take us seriously, and for that reason we like do have to take them seriously.
Well,
like,
I think an important way. I think an inextricable part of that conversation is this is an era that's dominated by the teen movie. Like,
of course,
this is like the teen movie existed in the 80s for sure, but there is a sort of
it's
redefining
a resurgence
of it,
yeah,
and a pushing forward even farther,
yes.
Into I think sort of the multiplex consciousness, the monoculture.
Well, you have these movies that yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah, but it's
no,
like,
no, no.
It's like Ten Things I Hate About You, and like all these movies that are like now like booming.
Right. And I think it's you can't have this conversation without emphasizing the fact that movies that star teen girls, that are about teen girls, that feature teen girl things, are considered frivolous.
Are never
They're considered unserious by default. They are considered niche, even though women are half the fucking population. So like when you have properties that harness the tone, the voice, the stylings of women from a female screenwriter, you have with that an inherent like shifting of the curve down to like Bring It On being like great for what it is, quote unquote, as instead of just being like a seminal teen classic, because there is that devaluing from Go. It's to be taken less seriously because it's for and for girls by women. It just that's just the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so much of the pop culture of that time aligns with that sensibility. And that sort of like the girls and the gays, like the girls and the teen boy gays, like that's a kind of demo that can get lumped together. Like there's a shared sensibility between the two. There's a sort of shared vocabulary. So there's so much crossover from like how the voice of like the adult gay man comes through in a way that speaks very succinctly to a female audience as well. And that is something like that influence coming off of Kevin Williamson, Don Mancini, Darren Stein, and you get into a movie like this where it's like an actual female screenwriter and there's such overlaps there, and all of it combined is something that you consider frivolous, that is just the sort of fluffy byproduct of pop culture as opposed to like essential cultural texts of the era.
Yeah, and for many, you know, like queer creators at this time, it was a really good way to work within the four quadrant system. Like yeah, it's a totally way to like milk that demographic for yourself because you understand it in this particular way. And like I've mentioned this before on Mike, but like teenage girls dictate what's cool. They yes. dictate what's successful. And like it's so insane to see like over and over again the things that are marketed specifically for them be frivolized and be like, you know, fluffed, because yeah. it's like they are the people that are telling you what to go see and when. And like that can't be ignored. What were you gonna say? J-Gus?
I don't even know.
Much to think about.
I mean, yeah, I think what you had mentioned about, I think it's for me growing up at this time as well, like coming from the like male closeted POV, I feel like a lot sure. of these movies are, or were, as you were mentioning with jokes, it's like was consistently like the when you have the Brokeback Mountain rise where it's like, cool, we have like a queer lead, but at the mm-hmm. same time, how many jokes were made about like Brokeback Mountain or all yeah, these queer
it was,
movies?
It was turned into like a homophobic meme. It right. was turned into a joke meme about gays.
Right. They're like, oh, we're woke because we made a gay movie, but like, gay? And you're exactly. like, oh?
Yeah. okay.
Right. Like, this doesn't make sense, but... No, it's all fascinating. What you had also mentioned, which I think ties to Kirsten Dunst, is I think like her rise is so
yeah.
tied in with a lot of this change, because she has really gone through, I would say, like four decades or like four like
she's been
not
with
decades,
us for
but, like,
fucking ever, right, just delivering
like,
at every
child
turn.
Actress Jumanji, you know what I mean? But like every she's had so many periods of yeah. change as an actress that have mm-hmm. all sort of been so distinctly tied to like their time period. So mm-hmm. like with Bring It On, the year before with 99, she has The Virgin Suicides, Drop Dead Gorgeous, and Dick. Yep. All three of those movies, which are
unbelievable.
Like fucking phenomenal and like are integral
and she's doing something so different in each one
each
of those
one
and they're my all, god
but they're also all commenting on society and yeah. the time. Like Dick is commenting, it's like about Richard Nixon, but it's also commenting about like the ways in which, like as you were saying, how teenage girls can dictate yeah. the culture. It's about literally two
and
teenage
girls. And how they're
not
taken seriously.
Dictating the culture, right.
How they're able to infiltrate an entire presidential administration.
Right.
Because nobody considers them a threat to anything. Nobody
Absolutely.
Remarks upon them because they're just these ditzy girls.
Right. And then you have Drop Dead Gorgeous, where you have these ditzy girls like competing in a like competition. They're being murdered. But you're just like... Oh, it's probably nothing. Like, we don't have to worry about it. It's probably not Kirsten Dunst because she's just, like, such a good girl. Like, she has such a wholesome family.
I love
you
that fucking
I mean?
Movie.
So we just,
Let
like, keep going through and we're ignoring these things and these movies because they don't make any money. But you're like, these were such important texts for her to build yeah. her career. And... It's just so fucking fascinating.
Well, and it's frustrating because you have an incredible movie year like 1999, and you know what we talk about from a year like that is movies like Election,
right?
Like are movies that rose to this like critical threshold,
The Matrix.
Where they're very that are very, you know, important. And the whole point of like the Ots Pod that I do with Sam Weinman is to say that like, okay, yes, I liked those movies too, but the ones that I was watching at sleepovers, the ones that I was quoting with my friends, the ones that were shaping my sort of day-to-day sense of humor and point of view on pop culture were the Stickets of the world. They were the Bring It Ons. They were the Drop Dead Gorgeouses. They were the ones that we now, like, as, you know, taste making, as, like, film programming, festival programming, 20-something, 30-somethings, say, like, ooh, it's my turn? The midnight movie this week is going to be my favorite thing when I was fucking 15 years old.
Right.
And I just, I don't, there's going to be so much conversation around movies like Matrix and Election. I don't need to talk about those movies. Those are covered. Those are spoken for.
Right.
And we, and this movie is not trash. Bring It On is not trash. But, like, the movies that I think are perceived as trash from this time, so much of what we cover on the Aughts Pod, movies like, you know, I Know Who Killed Me, movies like The Quiet, movies like The Hitcher remake, which are consigned, I think, or at least remembered off the top of one's mind as trash.
Right.
One must speak for the trash, because these are the things that we were pulling off the video store shelves. We need Oscar the Grouches. And we're these were the things that were defining our sort of days and nights with people.
Absolutely.
And not just the movies that rose to, like, level of Oscar conversation or, like, Sundance Darling.
Well, I think then with Bring It On, I think this movie changes the I think this sort of is that in-between point where I think, like, this, Mean Girls, and there's a few others that really break through, where it is that midnight movie that you're having at sleepover camp, but it's also, like, a massive success. Like, how, like, this movie, like, made so much fucking money and then, like, spawned, like, a, just a franchise. But if for it to, like, also be viewed sort of as, you know, this nothing that, like, teenage girls are gonna, like, watch at a sleepover camp, but then also this movie that, like, everyone knew about, like, I knew about Bring It On. I, like, somehow went through life without watching it. But
I'm honestly just, I'm surprised you just didn't, like, by accident.
I know.
Like, I was at a friend's house and Bring It On ended up. Like, I'm surprised it just didn't occur in your life.
You actually have no idea how much I'm enjoying this, because you won't know this, but, like, I literally didn't watch anything growing up.
She actually famously had only seen four movies growing up.
Okay, it's not exactly four movies, but honestly, it's in that ballpark.
It was the last Temptation of Christ.
Was there a reason for that?
Yeah, I mean, like, my parents were just very much more into the, like, you should read and you should enrich your mind and you should go outside, and they didn't think a lot of stuff at this time was appropriate. So I, you know, I saw a couple old musicals, saw a couple seminal texts, but as soon as I was like, I want to go to film school, they were like, okay, here's, like,
you have to watch a movie.
Here's Pulp Fiction, like, go ahead, well, you can watch it.
That's a fucking start.
I know.
Like, oh, I, that's the one movie my parents, that's one movie my parents ever told me I couldn't watch. And then they lasted, like, a couple months. And then finally one day my mom, because my mom and dad would go grocery shopping every Sunday. It would take, like, a couple hours. And my mom was like, okay, you can watch Pulp Fiction while we're gone. If you have any questions, feel free. But she did not want to be there. Like, she didn't want to watch it. And you know what? I'm fucking glad she wasn't there. Like, we don't talk about sexy things. We don't have those kinds of conversations with, it's just like my sister's married. She's been with the same guy for like 12 years now. She's 30. As far as I'm concerned, they've literally never had sex, and they won't, because that's like,
right.
Like, they do, but, like, for me, no, they haven't,
like,
because
they're just,
we just don't. Yeah. It's like, you could come to me if you ever had an issue, but, like, up to that point, that's not in our lives as family members.
Right.
So, like, we watched Election together. In fact, me and my mom, worst movie watching experience of my life.
That's an interesting one. That's a rough one.
Oh yeah, we were, because we'd heard all these amazing things about it. It was such this darling. So we rented it and we were watching it. It was just me and her at home. We, like, were sitting on opposite sides of the couch when we started watching the movie. We were, like, trying throughout the movie to get as far as possible from each other on opposite sides. Like, I was just practically crawling over the arm of the couch, because just, like, how far do I get from my mom while these sex things are happening on screen? And it ended, and we were both like, that movie was bad. That was, I don't know why people like that movie. That sucked. Like, I didn't like Election for years, because I was like, that movie's awful, because it made me feel awful.
Because the experience that you had,
deeply,
and I've revisited it since, like, oh, it's a really good movie.
You're like, oh, I guess Reese is kind of incredible in this. Yeah.
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 I
love those movies that parents, like, specifically single out. That, like, they're like, I don't want you to watch this movie. There was, like, my father consistently was like, I don't want you to watch, like, The Godfather or, like, Martin Scorsese movies. And I was like,
because of the violence?
Yes, the thing about violence. But I was like, okay, so The Godfather must be, like, the most grotesque, horrifying, bloody movie I've ever seen. And then you watch it and it's like, oh?
Yeah.
A horse head, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, my first movie memory ever is Hellraiser.
Oh, fuck.
Wow.
So it's not like that. It's not like that. It was a soft restriction. I think it was just it was mostly the GIMP scene. I think that my mom was like, no, you can't watch Pulp Fiction.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. That was, and that certainly, I remember the experience of seeing that for the first time. It was like, oh, that's the first time I've seen anything like that.
And also talking about like queer things that are then consistently like mocked and parodied in movies and TV. Like, I mean, the GIMP scene has consistently been like, still is like a go-to for people to make fun of. And it's like, of course, like a like more sexual sort of like queer undertones to it. And people are like, oh, let's mock that part of the movie.
Let's minimize that. Like, because we don't know what to do with it. And maybe we don't know if we're anti it. But if we just make fun of it and make it less then it can't hurt us.
Right.
And there's a fascinating, and I since I'm sure I was responsible for this digression, I think a really interesting thing about gayness in Bring It On is, yes, there is, the thing is, it doesn't feel disingenuous. It is of its time.
It's
and it doesn't feel like
genuine.
It doesn't feel like it is infusing more gay gags into the story than were evident in like a high school at that time.
Oh,
like,
guaranteed.
And that doesn't, not that that makes it okay. It's not like, I'm not like, oh, that's a huge problem. I honestly don't think it's a huge problem. I think, but like, there is like an attachment to sort of like shame and being gay, but it only comes from the shitty boys who are bad at sports and get made fun of a lot. And there's a derisive reaction from Jan when he is called gay and he hates it and he doesn't like it. But he does not judge less.
No.
He doesn't hate less. It's kind of like, well, yeah, I mean, like, I would like for him to just be like, whatever, it doesn't matter if I was gay. Like, being misidentified sucks. Like, I don't, like, I feel like in 2000 terms, I feel like Jan is a character where we see this interesting model of somebody who doesn't have a problem with gay people. He just doesn't like being called gay. And he doesn't like the idea of girls thinking he's gay because he wants to fuck girls. Like, so there's it's
very
fair.
Yeah, like, it's not like, he's not like he doesn't get a gold star as a character. But at the same time, his reaction to just being, to being intentionally and in a bullying way misinterpreted and misunderstood, it's just like, fuck you guys for like putting something on me and projecting, because you two boyfriends are definitely touching each other in the showers after the football game, kids. And but it's just, yeah, it's, and the girls are clearly okay with it.
They're fine,
like,
with
they're,
it.
Less is their GBF. Like, they love Less.
Oh, absolutely.
And like, Less gets a meet cute in
I
this
right.
movie.
I love Less.
Yes.
I love Less, him.
Less gets a meet cute in this movie. He's not even just like a sexless gay character. Like, insofar as anybody's fucking in this movie, Les gets to make eyes at another cheerleader boy and like get all sweaty about him. And that's his,
in a way that's realistic to high school as well. Like the sweaty, nervous.
It's a super sweet moment, actually. Like the way he's standing there just like waiting. It's not that he bumps into him, he's waiting for that guy to get off the floor. He's like, hey, it's really great job, you
nice
know.
Job.
It's like, this is adorable, actually.
Yeah, he's basically like pumping his fist after the other guy walks away after like a successful interaction with a crush. It's so
and
cute.
He's the only other character that gets a kind of romantic moment like that besides Torrance. It's not like Missy goes off and gets a boyfriend. It's not like everybody
that's the
gets
thing.
A partner in this movie
<We'll>
besides
<get there.
laughs> if we're talking about like how people are like coded, or at least like people in the groom are like saying things to them, when Missy walks in, people are basically like, oh, you're
lesbian.
Like a lesbian, and she never ever says no, but she also never says yes, but the way that they code her, you're like, oh, so you're lesbian or bi.
Yeah, this is like step on my throat, Missy.
Absolutely.
Like,
I
kind
mean,
of.
You gymnast,
like, they,
beautiful
no, they
woman,
set up,
you.
They set up every cue. They like put her in fucking Dickies. They put the chain wallet on her.
The cargo pants. The hair.
I mean,
the relationship
Eliza
with her brother, too, because if you juxtapose the relationship that Torrance has with her brother and Missy has with her brother, I feel like a lot of like at the times like, I feel like in media portrayals, like the queer sibling gets along really well with their other sibling, for some reason.
Well, the thing about, like, the idea of her getting along so much with Jesse Bradford's character, this era is so confused about queerness.
Yes.
That, like, it has to give you the same character split into two people with the Pantone siblings. So Torrance can flirt with Missy and make out
and up with Jesse
with Jesse
to Cliff or
whatever. Jesse, yeah. Like, I don't even remember his fucking name. What is it?
Right.
Cliff?
It's Cliff.
Yeah, like,
push him off the fucking cliff.
Yeah, she can share a bed with Missy, but she can kiss Cliff. And they're twins. They're not even siblings, they're twins.
They're twins.
They're like the same genetics split in half.
Bisexuality.
And that is Torrance's two primary concerns throughout this movie is Missy and Cliff. It's like, just let her fucking have Missy. Just let her fucking have Missy. She shows up at the house. She sees Cliff at his house, and he opens the door, and she's like, not happy, surprised to see him, because she's like, I'm sorry, I'm looking for Missy.
Right.
And the whole first conversation in their home is her rolling her eyes at Cliff while she's like, no, I'm trying to talk to Missy. Like, what the fuck are you doing here?
Right. And their whole, like, toothbrush thing, like, you know it should have been her and Missy, because, like,
absolutely.
Okay, so she's like, see him playing the guitar or whatever, they go brush. Like, no, her and Missy are gonna go brush their teeth, and they're gonna be brushing their teeth, and they're gonna look at each other and be like, you wanna, like, maybe, like,
do some stuff?
I have to give Peyton Reed so much credit, though, for making a toothbrushing scene, like, maybe the most sexual thing in this entire film.
It's so, that scene is so impressive, because it goes on forever.
Too long.
Forever.
Yeah.
It's not
too long, but it's like the pee sequence in A League of Their Own, where Tom Hanks keeps pissing, and you're like, wow, this is really still going, and the toothbrush, you're like, wow, they're really still brushing their teeth.
And all credit where it's due to Jesse Bradford for being so charming. He really, I don't hate Cliff. I just love Missy so much that Cliff should die.
When
Cliff does the thing, like, finally at the end of this wordless sequence where he just looks at Torrance, smiles, and then, like, hastily wipes his mouth, I was like, that's one of those ones where, like, I don't get, like wide-eyed over boys, but for rarely. And that's one of those moments where, like, man, you even got me with that one. Like, you even hit me with the charm offensive on that. And Kyle Gallner is, like, the ultimate example of that for me. Like, Kyle Gallner's magnetism is so powerful, and I know it because I am powerless before Kyle Gallner. And he's just a guy. So, like, that's weird for me. But, like, Kyle Gallner just breaks my heart, and I love him all the time. But, like, this movie, like, a thing about, you watch these movies and it's like, I just don't get how anybody is straight.
Yes.
Like, I don't get how anybody is. Because, like, what is it even like watching things without looking at this, not even looking for, but without just seeing this layer intrinsically?
Yeah. Right.
How fucking boring.
And I mean, even if you want to, like, layer in, like, the ISIS and, like, the whole other element of it, is like, while that's not necessarily, like, as textual as, like, Missy or something, there is, like, that, like, whole, like, the dynamic between the two of them. And if that, like, ISIS part had, I feel like, a more screen time, like, there would have been something there.
Enemies to lovers, you're feeling.
Yeah.
Right. There's something about that, like, and there's nothing gayer than, like, than straight men playing sports. Like, there's nothing gayer than straight men. And so then, like, you see men in, like, a sports athletic competitive context, and there's such a charged tension between them. Like, the implication of, like, any face-to-face between two intensely competitive athletes is, okay, kiss him. Like, just kiss.
Exactly.
Like, when you see those moments between Torrance and when you see them between, like, Gabriel Union and Kirsten Dunst, you're like, okay, kiss her.
Right.
Like, it just feels so reminiscent of that kind of, like, palpable energy between two people. It feels like the logical conclusion.
I think that's what this movie does lovely, is that, like, when do we really have, like, women competing against women in sports where there's not, like, a male sort of in the way, or there's, like, they're not competing for a male. Like, it's really just, like, these, like, athletic powerful women competing against other athletic, powerful women.
And I would say, like,
that's very cool.
A lot of credit to Jessica I don't know if it's Bendinger or Bendinger. Jessica.
I've committed to Bendinger, but like, let's go with it. Bendinger, but like, that's the, you can say one and I'll say the other and we'll have the basis.
Jessica, come on the pod.
we've covered Stick It in the past, and I'm sure we said it very inconsistently on that episode too. But I feel like a lot of credit to her for, like, yes, Isis and Torrance are very much at odds, but there's not a lot of bitch fighting, which is honestly incredibly impressive. Like,
it makes, like, that's why I feel like that's why Bring It On holds up so well.
Yes.
Is because it doesn't, a thing about the 2000s, especially when you hit that post 9/11 strain, a thing about the 2000s, well, I think a thing about, like, this movie in particular, the post, like, the Kevin Williamson Scream era through the bifurcation zone at 9/11, and then the sort of the Saw era that will kick off in earnest after that, and how that influences horror films subsequently and like the next decade from there. I think what you see in a movie like this is the sincerity that was still in place in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Like, we were sincere, like, versus when irony and cynicism.
Yes. I was going to say, the cynicism hasn't kicked in yet.
Yeah, yeah, we're, and we're so not this Deadpool is a very yet. This is a very sincere, well, Juno, I mean, Jesus. Like,
right. Shrek.
This is a very sincere, self-awareness was not something that was wielded with disdain at this point.
Yes.
Where, like, obviously Scream is very self-aware. That's a part of its whole deal. But there, it, like, it takes an edge to it.
But it's earnest. It's genuine and, with its emotions. It's not like...
Yeah.
It's, if Scream was made to... Well, I mean, if they have made Scream today. But there's a difference between, like, that sort of metatextual commentary on, like, what's going on with the situation versus, like, what we're seeing today where people are, like, mocking... They're, like, not... They're making fun of the thing that they're in rather than, like, making light and having fun about the thing that they're in.
The whole And I think, when we get into that post-9/11 strain, that, like, cynicism strain, what we see is those movies are so cruel. There's so much cruelty in 2000s proper movies, and particularly as we see it in horror. And, like a signature of those, like, those, you know, the remake factory movies like Sorority Row, movies like Cry Wolf, is that friends are fucking horrible to each other.
Right.
Everybody is mean. Friend groups are built on, like, backstabbing and paranoia and cruelty and talking shit. And we're still in this sincere era. And what you ultimately have here is a movie where, like, the friends show up for each other. The friends support one another. And even, like, by the end, Courtney comes around and is the one, like, when they're receiving their second place trophy, she's the one who leads the Toros and going, second place? Hell yeah. And she was the one who wanted to fucking walk all over the Clovers and just use their stolen routines because that was how you won. And you were there to fucking win. So that's Courtney's arc, is bringing it around to a place of kindness. And there is such a core of kindness to this movie that it makes the meanness, like, coming from the fatphobic jokes and coming from the gay gags and things like that, it's trying to tell you all along that, like, well, what our point here is this good stuff, but we make jokes like these in the millennium era, and we all don't take it seriously, so it's fine, it's just gags. But, like, there is a core of sweetness and sincerity to this movie that I think allows for it to hold up, to age well, because the takeaway from it is not the cruelty of the characters. And it stands out in contrast to sort of the purity of it overall, for me.
I agree. It's sort of like, in, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a rise in sort of like this wholesome type of cinema, not, and, you know, across a variety of genres, of being like, right, we can have people supporting each other, and, like, that doesn't take away from whatever we're trying to do with the movie. Mm. But yeah, like, I agree with you on that. I feel like this is kind of from a more innocent era where it was like, you had the mean girl, you have Big Red, but you don't feel the need to, like, take these personal shots when it actually comes to the plot and the arcs of the main characters. Mm-hmm. You can pack in the offensive jokes on the side for, you know, legitimate quote-unquote humor, but when you actually get to the meat of the story.
Which at the time we were laughing our fucking asses off with abandon.
Yeah.
And I think a great thing about, And sometimes you see movies like this that are just so nice, where like you have, and Stick It is similar, where you have your antagonist as kind of like a periphery thing. Like Big Red is the antagonist of this movie, and everyone else is like pretty much doing their best.
Exactly.
Well, and so the shittiness of it, and like the Craven, you steal routines, you're an asshole, and Aaron's a cheating bastard. Like they get minimal screen time. So like we don't have the, like you said, it's just girls competing against girls for this cheer title. Well, teams competing against teams. There are male cheerleaders, obviously.
Right.
But like, you don't have. I love that Missy and Cliff are siblings. So it's not Torrance and Missy vying for Cliff.
Exactly.
But there isn't a note at all of anybody is. They're not shoehorning a love story plot that lasts any more than 5 seconds with tension, because Cliff is pissed at Torrance for like one instance in a hallway, and then Missy's like, get the fuck over yourself, Cliff, try harder. And right. She's not like, and she's telling, like, yeah, he saw her kissing her ex and he overreacts because it's like, hey, that was her boyfriend 15 minutes ago and you just got here, so go fuck yourself, Cliff, like grow up. And then Missy isn't like, hey, like I'll talk to Torrance. She's like, you're being a pissy baby, why don't you sack up and go like tell her how you feel and actually try harder this time.
That is,
and that's the end of that fucking problem.
Right. That is all like the fake out that we need when it comes to relationship
that's
shit.
It.
Because it's like we all that's know it. They're ending up together. We don't need to spend 20 minutes pretending that they're not.
This is not Gossip Girl. We do not need seasons devoted to poor communication yeah. and like backs and forths. That's it. What do we want? We want the cheers. We want Missy and Torrance. We want the one-liners. We don't want this. We don't need convoluted shit with some like romance that you're going to plug in on the side. Like, no, not at all. Don't distract us with that. And let us all know that Big Red sucks.
She does
suck.
So
we can all rally around Big Red. And like the factionalizing of the cheerleaders is fun. And you get the like Courtney Whitney duo, which you have to have as a mean girl setup in a cheerleading movie. But like, we're not belaboring. We don't have like side scenes where Whitney and Courtney are back channeling against Torrance. It's just like whatever's happening right in front of you is all that matters.
Right.
And that is a delightful kind of levity in a movie like this.
It's so nice.
I agree. I feel like I think the thing that, as we've talked about, like aging with this movie and stuff like mm-hmm. that, is I think one of the things that's not aged poorly, but not necessarily the best. I think it's a sort of double-edged sword, is I think that this movie is doing fantastic things in its conversation about like appropriation, specifically with like these white teams like taking black, you know, their whole performance
is
basically just stealing it down and dumbing it down so like more white audiences can take
it
in. Right, exactly. And the only sort of like, I think that's especially for a 2000s movie, that's phenomenal to do. I just think it's the hiccup is that it's this movie sort of gets into like the white savior-y of it all, where sort of Kirsten Dunst like comes over and she's like, we're seeing all of this like through the white POV and sort of the like everyone on the Clovers.
They're
really sort of like stereotypical like angry black women. Like that's sort of like the pitch on them.
That's an interesting, I think that's it, because I think in its 1999-2000 way, I think it does actually a pretty capable job. You have the whole scene where Torrance shows up to pay their way to Nationals,
right.
And Isis is like, you can shove that up your ass, Marshmallow.
Right. No, absolutely.
And sends her packing, and then they very much get there on their own terms. But then at the same time, I think there's an interesting, and this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, particularly in the context of queer characters, and I can't speak to black characters, as I'm not a black individual, but like there's such a one of the most fucked up things about stereotypes is that by perpetuating negative stereotypes and boiling people down to them, you rob a character at some points, I feel like, of being able to embody aspects of an experience that may be authentic to that community
100%.
And that group, because then they are then laden with things that have become pejorative cliches, whereas like, you know, the gay best friend is a trope, and it sucks when somebody's just distilled down to the gay best friend and all that trappings that it becomes, but the idea, what the reality of certain attributes of that gay best friend character are real to the lived experience of certain gay individuals in this world. And the idea that the idea that in an assertive black character, the idea of a black character who chews the scenery and is charismatic and is memorable and is fucking pissed off, rightfully so.
For sure.
Because of how she's been exploited by these white bitches from San Diego. Like, the idea that there is the unfortunate fact of there being her ISIS being saddled with the notion of an angry black woman archetype being thrown on her when a black woman has every right to be angry externalize that.
Yes.
It fucking sucks how it robs characters of certain, I think, opportunities to be most fully and loudly and colorfully and vibrantly themselves when aspects that are their most heightened are the ones that are most strapped to tropes and cliches that have done harm. And it fucking sucks. It just fucking sucks.
I completely agree. And it's, I think where we are at now is like we are having the gay best friend, or like we're able to see that, but they're given an interiority that we didn't have before. Where
right,
like,
and that's, it's which is giving like, people an interior life.
Which is where I think that's where this movie sort of, that's like the fall, if you're going to like examine it through that cultural lens, is where it falters, because you know, the Clovers are relegated to really like not a lot of screen time. We don't see them unless they're having a conversation with the white women. So we don't get any of their interiority or their decision making other than
like. That's not necessarily true. We do see them gym scene with one another where they are specifically crafting the letter about what they mean to the community cheerleaders. And they're writing to the host of a black talk show.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's like very relegated to the side, and it takes at least for me, that was my read of it.
That's the bullshit of supporting characters who wouldn't necessarily get more time because they're supporting characters,
yes. Right? Yes,
but like, that's the fucking nightmare of such lack of representation is that. When you get the few examples that emerge and get to exist on an open at 3,000 screens level, bear the weight of responsibility for everything.
For sure.
So like we have to think of this in terms of like, yes, in major studio releases, we only get to see black, brown characters, queer characters having X amount of screen time. Versus like if black creators, queer creators just got to make art that put themselves in their stories and their faces and their array of experiences and physical forms of presentation front and center, then like having queer side characters wouldn't be an affront to the queer experience because we wouldn't simply be relegated to side characters.
It's
a reminder of that starvation, the mentality that comes along with a system-wide lack of opportunity for people to have their shots at being the leads, which, of course, at this time in 1999, it's interesting, black cinema was kind of like, there was more
growing.
Of kind of
it was like having
coalesced
a moment.
Movement
yeah.
in the 90s around black cinema than like, I think we're having that now, but like the 90s was actually kind of great time for black cinema.
And I mean, they're all great in it too.
The Wayans brothers,
right.
Like
exactly.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like it sucks that because it, like with Promising Young Woman, I feel like this was a conversation too, where like we should be examining like racial equity in any fucking thing we watch. But it puts a movie like Promising Young Woman in the situation where it can field the critique of being like, this is white feminism. Look at all like this movie's just so white. It's white. Accurate. I don't need Emerald Fennell to tell an intersectional story because I can't purport to be an authority on intersectional narrative storytelling. So I like, is it more important that somebody who will not necessarily serve an intersectional story well use their platform to be the voice of that? Or is it more important for that person to gain a sense of status and then to, like, favored nations, like, you go up the ladder, you reach a hand back, and you pull up someone next to you
yes.
to tell their story in the fashion that you have gotten to?
Well, we've talked
because
about
I don't want to see, I don't want to see stories done poorly.
Exactly.
By people who shouldn't be the ones in the driver's seat. So it, you know, we have white Peyton Reed, white director. We have Bettinger, white female screenwriter. you know, telling their story through the lens through which they have experienced this world. And it becomes a matter of, and in 1999, 2000, this isn't even a consideration, but it's like, you know, would they have served the story as well to purvey the authentic Black lived experience of the Clovers, which is something we see later installments of the Bring It On franchise really fucking trip on.
Yes. Right.
When you have Hayden Panettiere showing up and saving Solange's, you know, oh, cheer team from themselves.
It's bad.
With Solange, like, Solange pushing back. She's a fucking tough captain. She very much exists in the framework of ISIS. But that's not even, like, squad versus squad. That's Hayden and Solange on the same squad being, like, dueling alphas.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that's, like, that's the Hayden installment is not the most racist Bring It On. Like,
They just keep bringing it on.
Yeah.
So, like, you see what happens when, like, because it takes that DNA of what they're doing in the initial Bring It On that definitely needs work, but I think is succeeding more in the subsequent installments. But you see those subsequent installments and be like, oh, this is what we do in Bring It On. It's equality. And then you just have people really fucking overplaying their hand in, like, race relations and bringing characters and storylines together that they cannot responsibly field. And you get these, like, examples of Hands Across America. Fucking, we're all just gonna solve inequality together. And it's like, oh, this is rough. It's thank God this went straight to TV, because a theatrical release would have been fucking catastrophic.
Would have been a mess. Yeah.
And so we've talked about, as you, the thing you were saying earlier, I think I'm sure me and Brooke both completely agree, is that we've talked about this a lot of directors who have made movies who they maybe aren't equipped for the material, where it's just like, this is, like, you are a great director with your field, but it is really about, like, are you equipped to tell the proper narrative? Like, do you have the bones? And I think the thing with Peyton Reed, which is where this movie does sing, is that, like, he has phenomenal comedic chops, and he knows how to weaponize Kirsten Dunst. He knows how to weaponize, like, the banter, the lines. He knows how to, use Jessica's script. Like, if you watched Down With Love, I don't know who did he didn't write that, right?
I don't know, I'll have to double check.
The way that he directs that movie is, like, he is so good at using specific styles of comedy. So, like, when this movie sings, it is, you can tell, like, this is, like, where Peyton Reed and Jessica were really, like, in their wheelhouse. And then when you have the moments that falter are, of course, where you're like, ah, like, this is not necessarily, like, what you're comfortable with, but, like, that happens. But, like, for a movie in the 2000s, as we were saying, pretty goddamn impressive to see what they were tackling, and especially, like, queerness with race all in, like, 90 minutes. It's like, oh, fuck.
The hindsight view of this, like, watching the razor's edge that they're walking on and seeing how, like, pretty effectively they're doing it is, like, this should have been one of those that we consigned to history. Like, everything about this movie says it should have been one of those ones where we loved it at the time, and then we watch it now and we're like, how did we let ourselves do this?
Yeah.
And yet it still manages, I feel, to maintain what makes it beloved. To the point where, like, it's not like this is the arbiter of what works and what doesn't, but, like, EW did, like, you know, the 20th anniversary retrospective, like reunion for Bring It On when it came around, and, like, the whole, like, the cast participated in it, Peyton participated in it, and it's a movie that we still, even with the changing mores of our time, it still can be lionized in this way that doesn't seem to, the examination around it, I feel like, collectively is like, yeah. Like, it was a time and a place, but we're not ashamed of this one. And there are plenty of things from this time, anything Eli Roth made, that are shameful examples of, like, that virulent sort of strain of everybody's a target. Where the challenge of that era and the everybody's a target sense was, like, people being like, I really think, and this touches on something I said before of, like, well, what? Everything is a target, so anybody has the right to make any joke they want. Like, anybody, any old person has the right to joke about any old thing. And the idea of people having lanes was not a conversation we were having at the time. But, like, you watch this and there is something so white about
definitely.
It that I think it's like, I think it's in its way, it's an asset.
I agree.
Because it's not trying to be anything but super fucking white millennial high school experience. It's not like, it in that's in the way that Jennifer's Body did, like what Diablo Cody did with Juno as well, it creates a vernacular, literally. It creates a fucking language of its own in universe, as opposed to piggybacking off of what may have been popular in the zeitgeist at the time, which is so often what is appropriated from Black folks and then brought into different whitewashed contexts by people who don't know how to use that vernacular. It instead uses a language unto itself to create lives and texture for these characters, so that it becomes almost like an artifact of its own whiteness.
Yeah, it's like,
which is fascinating.
The Valley Girl aesthetic is like, yes, so valuable and should be used, yeah, much more, honestly. Yeah. Like,
honestly,
I feel like we've fallen out of that into some,
not the film,
some
Valley Girl,
worse. Oh, right. I totally forgot about that movie. Into some worse, like, ideas of what young people are and, yeah, like how they, yeah, do things. But like this kind of like, you know, heightened ditziness that was, yeah, like in the high school retrospective is so lovely and like so of its
and almost
time.
Like it's almost like feels empowering, yes, now when you watch it. The idea of being so shamelessly girl.
Yes.
The idea of being so shamelessly, sincerely sort of feminine in every aspect is so joyful. And it's like, yes, let's make a fucking meal out of this. Like, to the point where, like, it's so, there's this like messy embrace of queerness in this movie where, like, I love the scene in the car is, oh, still a classic.
I think about that,
like,
scene all the time.
I mean, like, it's like, oh my God, send me back to my teen years so I can just have this scene in the car. Like, I feel so nostalgic during that scene because, I mean, car rides with groups of friends, come on.
A classic, and, as Love, Simon, like, shows us.
Oh, yeah. Ugh.
I don't know. Ugh. But, like, they pull up in the fucking wood panel Jeep, first, mm-hmm, of all.
It's beautiful.
And, like, iconic car. And then, like, they honk that horn and Eliza Dushku comes out looking like an entire fucking buffet.
A four-course meal.
Oof. Oh, my Christ on a cross. And they, like, she's all bashful.
Brooke actually saw that movie growing up.
Christ on a cross.
I did. Have you seen that? Christ on a cross? It's her favorite film. It's on her Letterboxd top four. Sorry.
I mean, I did go see the Christ on a Cross movie with a church group freshman year of college.
Oh,
and that,
boy,
was an interesting experience. The ticket was free since when I went with them, so I went. And it wasn't my church group, but I didn't go to church. But, like, they're in, like, she comes out, and the way they're all just, like, catcalling her and hyping her up, I was like, this is so cute. This is so friend group. This is, like, you absolutely, like, you got your gay friend in the car, you got your girl best friend in the front seat, you got the other guy in the back seat just, like,
hyping you
her
up. It's
so joyful, and she starts, yes, dancing, and she's just starts feeling herself, and she's so hot. Bless you, Eliza. And then she gets in the car, and they just have, they have a conversation you can really imagine people having.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Where, like, the language is heightened in that way that it is in this script. But, like, when they're, she's like, you know, Missy's asking them about the dynamics of the cheer group, and she's like, Whitney and Courtney, dykedelic? And I was like, I fucking love this. Like, I want to ask my friends that question now. Like, you know, seeing an actress on screen who gives off gay vibes, I want to be like, dykedelic? Like, it doesn't, it's not hurting my feelings to watch that scene. And I am a queer woman.
Yes.
I identify myself, you know, I am not a lesbian. I identify as a panoramic romantic gray asexual, who's definitely, like, homo preferential. Men are definitely the exception and not the rule. And but, like, you know, and then you have, you know, dykedelic, and they're like, oh no, definitely not. And it's like, okay, well, this, we'll get to this in a second, but we'll put a pin in dykedelic. And then you get that, like, very enduring moment where they, like, you know, Jan and Les are talking about, like,
yes,
people
this
always
moment,
thinking they're gay.
This moment.
And Missy just, like, very forwardly, with no judgment, but simply asks in the most dispassionate way, are you gay? Like, what is the deal with you guys in, like, being gay? Like, huh? Like, just spill. Like, give me the tea. And the Les's fucking perfect answer of, like, well, Jan's straight, but I'm controversial. And I fucking love that as an answer in 2000. Like, I'm because it's true. It is controversial.
It is.
It's not just okay in the place he lives, even though we never feel like Les is in danger.
No.
This is not a movie about Les being in danger. The homophobia, insofar as it can be benign, is benign. It's never meant to be conveyed in a threatening sense. And the cheerleader boys are always superior to the athletes who are giving them shit. And they're better looking and they're cool.
Nice boys.
And then, like, then, you know, and that's when Eliza leans forward, so Missy leans forward. He goes,
oh, you,
are you telling me? You try to tell me
speak
you speak
fag?
Fag?
Oh, fluently.
Like, also love that.
It's
like
the craziest line.
It's the craziest line, but I was like, this feels like a conversation that girls and gays have in the car with each other.
Yeah.
Like, this feels like a conversation that would happen right now with my friends in the car with one another. When I did the Queer Wolf podcast and we talked about Seed of Chucky, Don Mancini was kind enough to, they reached out to him like, do you want to give us a little comment? Like, we're talking about the episode, we're talking about Seed of Chucky on the show this time. Like, is there anything you want to add? We could edit in. And he said in this like great like voice memo he left us that like with Bride, he was really like dipping his toe in to like being a queer right out queer writer on screen with Bride. And that was really where he wanted to like kind of christen it. But then by Seed of Chucky, as he said, he quote went full fab. And it was just like, you know what? That's Don framing his experience and his intentions about this movie. And we're like, I'm not going to tell Don in this moment that those words aren't okay, that he can't say that. And he meant it. Like, to use that word as a queer person, it's a word with intention. When you are saying that, it is sort of, I feel like it is meant to convey a specific thing. And not everybody is okay with it. It's not a word I go throwing
exactly
around. Exactly. But like, when I find that it is applied in conversation with friends of mine who are queer, particularly with gay men, it's not a word that gets thrown about a lot, but when it does, there is a meaning behind
yeah
it. There is a punch, there is an intent, there is a sense of humor, there is an effect that is meant to be delivered. And there is a, and sometimes that is with a sense of playfulness, sometimes that is with a sardonic sensibility behind it. And when you see in this movie Missy say, are you trying to tell me you speak fag? And Les just nonchalantly say, fluently. Like, it's a bonding moment for them.
Yeah.
And you can tell there's a trust between all four of the characters in this car where, like, I couldn't impeach this moment because I couldn't say this whole car experience would not happen in my own life. Right.
Totally. And, like,
I could not say that I would not text a friend and be like,
Dykedelic? Like, Dykedelic, like, in and of itself is such a good line, too, because, like, it's a great callback to Whitney and Courtney calling Missy, like, quote, an Uber dyke and shit like that and being
exactly
like, where'd
like,
you
and
park
because
your
they
Harley?
Say it,
yeah.
Because they say it, they're fucking bitches.
Yeah.
Because there isn't a trust there. There isn't a shared language and respect there. And we know they're fucking bitches. The movie wants us to
of
know.
Of course.
That. Also, they are Dykedelic. They are definitely proto-Britannia.
Oh, please.
Like, this
no
is
question.
Britney and Santana of
Bring
It On.
That's what I was going to say. Hey, Glee really taking a lot of notes from Bring It On, huh?
Yeah, like, I have to believe when Britannia was conceived, it was like, oh yeah, I remember when I watched Bring It On. Yeah.
Look,
like, I wrote that fan fiction. I wrote that AO3 in my head when I saw
God,
that, and now
oh,
I make
no
my own shit. And here they
it's
come.
Kind of powerful to have queer women who are like mean, because I think that maybe
yes
that might be what we're looking for a little bit. Like,
and it's also hot.
Yeah, like, I want women to be mean to me. So sue me. Like,
it's so fucked up. It's so fucked up how the exploitation and violence against queer folks on screen has robbed us of just being able to relish in villains who happen to be
yes
queer.
Yes.
Because
yes
there's so much
yes
like queer makes people villains that it has made queer folks as villains
impossible
carry the weight of so much like pain and damage of the past
yeah
when villains are the best fucking parts
yes
when villains are the most
absolutely
fun
yeah
when villains are sexy and sumptuous and scene stealers. And the idea that we have to have a moral conundrum when we have a gay villainous presence on screen fucking sucks. Like,
it's
how
so annoying
dare time have taken that from us? Because we should just get to delight in these things.
Yes.
Like, we should get to delight in the Dykedelic bitches who are making Torrance's reign as cheer captain harder.
Yeah.
Because we should be able to celebrate these people. And it fucking sucks that has been taken from us.
All right, we're going to make it happen next couple of years. We're going to make it
bullshit
happen. Yeah.
And also, I feel like one more thing that in terms of like talking about the queerness of this movie just emphasizes so much how bisexuality just doesn't exist.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
bisexuality is just
not a concept.
It's not a concept. But like, only like bisexuality is barely a concept now
oh
in the discourse.
You're telling me.
Like, we're aware.
Yeah. Like, which like, I am not going to be the one to speak.
No,
on
you're
that,
good.
That
no,
you're
good.
Yeah.
Please.
Like, it's just, it's so fucking crazy
yeah
how, like, no matter how long the LGBTQIA plus alphabet gets, that B just manages to disappear all the goddamn time.
You like,
I don't know
oh
why
yeah
both
never
is just so hard to wrap one's mind around. Because if people could just be bi, then there could just be bi characters. Like,
a concept.
Like, even lob the homo jokes at them like this movie does. But, like, it's this movie doesn't even include bisexuality to make jokes
right,
about.
No, yes. Of course
like,
not.
If we could just let Missy be bi. Just let Whitney and Courtney be bi. So, like, Courtney can get her shit on with Whitney. And also, like, her and Jan can fuck on the side. That's
great.
Cool, man.
Good for
like,
her.
I don't care if Whitney and Courtney are involved. And I don't care if Courtney and Jan are involved. Let that milkshake all come together.
Like, the drama
such
to
not
be
an
had.
Option.
Yeah.
We are robbed of so much by people just not... But people just refusing to entertain the notion
the concept.
Of bisexuality.
Yes.
Dude, poor Eliza Dushku, man. Between this and Buffy, like...
A career? Where did it go?
No, I mean, just
what
like,
career?
She deserves to be canonically bi, like,
yes.
so many more
everything
times
about,
than she was.
Everything about the screen presence of, and bless her heart, I think she's as straight as the day is
oh,
long.
I know.
There's nothing not bisexual about Eliza Dushku when she is on screen.
Yes.
When she... The way Eliza Dushku wears a tank top belongs to the lesbians. Mm. There's just simply no negotiating that. There is nothing heterosexual
no.
about, like, we don't, like, Courtney being like, we don't allow tattoos.
And then she smudges the goddamn tattoo.
Woof, I'm sweating
suggestively
here.
Licking her middle finger in the direction of Courtney and, like, wiping the pen ink off of her skin.
Has there any been
Everything
anything hotter?
Everything about yeah. Missy bleeds. Everything about Missy bleeds flirting with women. This entire, I mean, there, I love, like, again, how could you enjoy anything if you're not seeing the gay shit?
I know,
happen?
Right? It must
like,
be so
that
boring.
Scene,
couldn't be me.
The scene, like, the sleepover scene where, like, she, you know, Torrance has her little flirtation with Cliff. There's him playing the music. There's the toothbrushes. And then she gets back in bed and you just see, like, grumpy Missy. And she's like, do you have a thing for my brother? And it's not like
you have a thing for
like,
fucking
sorry,
me.
Girl. Yeah, it's like this is not Missy being sour because she's like, ew, you like my brother. This is Missy being sour because she's like, what do you mean you don't want me?
Right,
like,
I'm fucking
Missy's
in
annoyed.
Bed with you, motherfucker.
Yeah, like, yeah. like let's just turn our faces the other direction and like make this work, Tor. And it just it's so
It'd be a shame if
and,
we
like
were sleeping in my arm just like just grazed your face. Oh
yeah, like oops. It just, it like, just let, like, the amount of, and as I sent to Brooke in DMs
oh, yes.
before, like, as I was watching the episode tonight, like, the most palpable sexual tension in this entire movie comes after the cheer competition when they're still in Daytona, they're still on the mat, and, like, you know, Missy brings Torrance the spirit stick to, like, taunt her about, like, being afraid of the curse of dropping the spirit stick. And then she, like, tempts her with a little bit, and she drops it on the ground. And then they just have this multiple beats long, a nonverbal exchange, where they're just making extremely suggestive eyes at each
it's
other.
It's eye-fucking. Before, let's say it.
Oh, my God.
Be coward, say it.
It is.
It's true.
Like... Like, you look at, like, you watch, like, there are, like, so many gifs, every gif of Faith from Buffy.
Yes.
Where she's interacting
oh,
with Buffy.
God, I mean, come
it's just,
on.
Like, let these two bang, and then, like, the amount of just, like, suggestive eyes from Eliza to Sarah Michelle Gellar, and you, it just travels through, like, everything she does. You watch Wrong Turn. She's absolutely got the hots for Emmanuel,
yeah.
was it, Tricui's character in that?
It's crazy.
Like, and she's, again, in a tank top. And so, like, you watch this, and it's just, like,
the
this
power
is
of a tank
just,
top.
Look, you just,
the,
but
the
you have no
top.
Idea. Women arms on women?
Oh, concept?
Women
with
arms?
Women?
May
with
I,
arms?
May I present women arms?
Concept?
It's just,
yeah.
It's so unfair that we were never given the, yes, like, what is that word? Not culmination. It's sexual.
Climax?
Starts with a C.
Climax? Are we climaxing with Eliza Dushku?
No, I'll think of the word.
Okay.
Consummate.
The consummation
we
of.
We were not able to ever see the, like, we were not able to have the moment consummated mm-hmm. of, like, officially queer Eliza Dushku. Mm. In her run of, like, late 90s aughts movies that just, like, I mean, that was stolen from us as queers.
We need the consummation of Eliza Dushku.
Stolen!
Yeah, we do.
From us.
Look, I think I could spend, like, 45 minutes on how the 90s 2000s like combined like the idea of the alt girl with the idea of the gay girl. Oh, and like Christ. there's far too much there to get into, but like
that's its own bonus episode.
Exactly, like that's the problem with sort of like having, oh, you want like the outsider, you want the alt girl, like you want the cool rebel. Okay, well, like, she's gay. I'm sorry. It's happening.
Yeah. What you just described to me is a queer person.
Yes, exactly.
And then you make them, then you put them in the vessel of just like hot as hell Eliza Dushku. Right. And she's just one of those, like, she's one of those actors who, like, Eliza's another one of those. I've had to, like, I've really come to terms with Eliza Dushku as a screen presence in life. And Eliza's really another one. Like Hayden Panettiere, Eliza kind of always gave me what was promised. Yeah. Eliza Dushku always delivered what Eliza Dushku was meant to do.
To Dushku.
And when you see, when she's put,
when you see her
utilized correctly, when you see her set up to succeed with material that really fits her style and her presence and her persona, she's so captivating. Mm-hmm. She's such a, I think we, like, I feel like she just doesn't get enough credit, and maybe it's just because I'm a queer woman. I don't think she gets enough credit for how really magnetic she, because, like, she, that magnetism was what made her a kind of go-to star around that time. Like, it, you know, Faith is a great and, you know, cherished character in Buffy lore, but it's not like it gave her a ton to do. But, like, when you see how she sort of springboarded forward, it was just that it quality. It was just that thing, that set of intangibles. Yes, she's beautiful. In Hollywood, everybody's beautiful. But, like, when you see her, the camera loves her.
She's very magnetic. And, like, yeah.
She's so well utilized in this movie, getting to be funny. Eliza Dushku's good at being funny. She gets to be funny in this role, and she gets to train that sexiness that's really innate to her presence on screen. Like, she's not just that. I don't want to reduce her to that, but it is an elemental part of her appeal. And what this movie lets her do is be multiple things, be the alt girl, be funny, be kind of sardonic and wry, while also making the most of that sexuality, of that sex appeal.
Yeah.
And I think it gives the integrity to that particular brand of presence and charisma that she has, that she rarely got the chance to work with in her most active years. And that really upsets me for her. Like, she was so fucked over in egregious ways, yeah, by Hollywood. She was abused. She was mistreated. Terrible things happened to her.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate.
And then you see a rare situation like this where her talents were really made the most of. And it's similar to a Megan Fox.
Yes. Where, like, yes, very much so.
Completely.
Yeah, if the actor's jail thing, the reputational jail thing hadn't happened because of the fucking slut-shaming 2000s and the inability of the media, men, women, whatever, yeah, to cope with a character, with an actress who was participating in her celebrity making in a way that ran counter, in a way that put her on the wrong side of the angel whore binding.
Right, exactly.
Therefore, she was vilified and ripped apart.
Yeah.
As she said in a conversation I had with her, first and foremost, I'm a comedic actress. If anything, I'm a comedic actress. She got to do that in New Girl. She said that, like, the two things she's most proud of in her career are the New Girl and Jennifer's Body. And those are the roles where she got to be funny. She got to have stretched that muscle that's actually really quite honed for her. And I don't think Eliza got enough of that. I think she was always kind of taken a little too seriously. And I think she was reduced to that charisma and that sexiness. And it underserved her so much because she wasn't allowed to step out of it. And I think, you know, in a really reductive time, in a really terrible era for, like, celebrity writing and packaging and pop culture, there were rarely creative people who stepped up with enough imagination to be like, you know what? Let's give Eliza Dushku her fucking shining moment. Let's give Eliza Dushku the, like, great kind of body comedy that she deserves. Because she did. And she should have gotten.
Yeah.
And it just frustrates me that she's, for some reason, I'm just especially hung up on hers as a career. Like, I wish we could rewind time and go back and, like, retcon in the, like, you know, change one thing for the butterfly effect to give Eliza Dushku the career she should have had. And, like, similarly, like, I feel the same way about Megan Fox, because just injustice. Deserved more. It was a real injustice.
Yeah.
She did. And it would have been so easy to give her more by using the parts that she was exploited for and making the most of them. And I think this script really gives a roadmap for how that could have gone for her. And I wish it had.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And like, you know, what a good opportunity to talk about someone that, like, I don't know, we're never going to talk about again, probably, in terms
with Eliza. With Eliza.
Well, definitely.
Well, yeah, yes. she's largely backed out of the spotlight. She lives back home in Massachusetts now.
Hell
like,
yeah.
Boston.
She's a Bostonian.
Hell yeah.
Oh, she is a fucking proud Bostonian.
Jordan is a mega Bostonian. So
I feel like she would probably self-identify. I think she has self-identified as a mascot. Like, she's that kind of Bostonian.
That's what I do as well.
And,
yeah.
And that's precious. And but I think she
Eliza
like,
Dushu come
I
on the pod.
I think it's I know. She's a mom now. Like she's become a mom. Like I think if she it's something where I don't imagine she'll act unless she feels extremely compelled by very specific material. But like other than that, she's kind of walked away from it. Like she didn't really have, you know, it's sort of like she would have to I could imagine her like looking at something and be like, why the fuck shouldn't I have?
Yeah.
Why should I have stayed? Why was this good? Why was this working for me? How was this good for me? Like, and I couldn't blame her. I can't blame her for making the choice to be like, I'm not fucking in this game
anymore.
Good
because for
she her. Gave a lot to it. She gave too much to it. And I just would love to see, I would love it if somebody could really write something so compelling for her that was just right for her that she could come back into just to like fucking show off and be like, screw you people. Like I she's just deserved. She's earned a victory lap.
Absolutely.
And I hope we get to see that from her one day.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, we talked about how well this film endures, and like I think the performances are like a huge part of it, including her. So like that's like amazing. Like, I mean, Gabrielle Union is
fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I really was role. Just taken aback. It had been a minute since I'd watched it again, and I was just so taken aback by like that first confrontation between where Isis like chases Missy and Torrance down in the parking lot.
So awesome.
And just like the power you feel radiating.
Yeah.
Was like, oh my God. Gabrielle Union is so
young and
good
just
in
killing
this.
It.
And
it's
like,
incredible.
She just, you know, she has, you want to talk about people with good lives. Like, she has
the best family. Killing it
the
right
best
now.
Instagram.
Yeah.
She, like, I would
the
want
best
her
Instagram.
As a mother.
Absolutely.
As a wife. She just is so fucking
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Dwayne Wade is Mr. Gabrielle Union.
Oh,
yes,
oh please.
Yes.
And he's,
no
he's
question.
One of the greats to ever play the game, and he's still Mr. Gabrielle Union.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And like, you know, I love everything that like she's done, and obviously she still is like killing it on a regular basis. Like, she's having this really cool sort of like thriller resurgence. I mean, say what you will about Breaking In, but like, I think that we deserve to make her a star like in this way.
I think what she does in this movie is a testament to star power with like the most impressive supporting roles are the ones where you remember them being in a much bigger percentage of the movie than
they are.
Were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like in this movie. Like when you think of Bring It On and you think of Isis in this movie, you think of Gabrielle Union, you think of her as like
the
squaring off with
lead.
Torrance kind of constantly. Like you're like, oh yeah, they're
well,
just always going head to head. And it's like, no, she's in it for a few minutes, but her impact is so outsized compared to her screen
Absolutely.
Time. She's just ever present over the entire thing, and that is a fucking
no, you think
guaranteed.
Of her as second build, and she's actually like fourth build.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
That's
think,
amazing.
Yeah.
It's just, again, a testament. Everybody is so perfectly cast in this movie. Even, like, in particular, especially, in such a low-key way, Huntley Ritter, who plays Les.
Oh, yeah, he's so cute.
Who is just such a perfect, smooth 2000s boy, and is also, like, it doesn't get much more, like, gay canon than being a star of a David Dakota movie.
Yeah.
And, like, he's, like, in the first Voodoo Academy, which is just, I mean, it's softcore. And it's just, it's so gay, all out there in the open on its sleeve without being gay. Mm-hmm. Like David Dakota horror movies of the 2000s are, I feel like they epitomize the tension of that era where like the straight washing of things is the most gossamer thin coating. It's just like, how do we do the least to make this straight? Because gay is what we want, but we can't like say it. That's what David
Dakota
podcast.
Well,
and that's, yeah, and that's what, and that's, I feel like Huntley Ritter brings that specific, like, wink and a nod to you with his presence in this film, and I love that about him.
With the less storyline, just to like in terms of queerness, there was a whole scandal that was brought on when I think it was USA. They pretty much cut out all of the less business and like the conversations around like him and his queerness, but they left in all the insults about queerness. And this was like in 2008.
That feels like a very cable edit.
Exactly. Which got a lot of controversy, which also goes to show that it's fascinating at that time, because like, as we've been mentioning, this movie, it's not like necessarily white being like, this is gay or whatever, but like less is obviously the gay conversation and like all the queerness is revolving. Exactly. It is revolving around him.
Yeah.
And so then for a major network to be like, we're going to snip that part out, just I think goes to speak volumes about like necessarily the queer impact of that.
8 years later.
Right. Exactly.
They're like, oh no, we gotta
keep that.
Yeah. So fucking.
No. And it speaks to the like the again, because I think we think of like the idea of the, you know, the 21st century, like the notion of it sort of implies progress. But this is happening at a time like in 2000, George Bush is going to win the presidency.
Yeah.
He's going to fake win the presidency. And then from that, like we have, you know, and he's the defining era of what we're known as the neocons.
Right.
He was a quote unquote compassionate conservative, like the Christian values, Bible guy, hate the sin, love the sinner kind of thing. And so we get a first term of Bush. We have 9/11 happen. And then we have this, you know, in the way that happens with wartime presidents, you get that rally around the flag effect. And then he carries that juice of like the wartime commander in chief into his 2004 reelection, in which point a centerpiece of his campaign is banning marriage equality.
Right.
Is the wanting to get a constitutional amendment put in the books.
Yeah.
That says gay people cannot get married. So this is the era in which like that's happening, while like the Trevor Project emerges with like the It Gets Better campaign, and there start to be these sort of new wave of queer activism, in the way that like we saw like a surge in queer activism obviously in the 1980s around the emergence of the AIDS crisis and organizations like ACT UP. And in the 90s, we have the don't ask, don't tell culture.
Oh, who could forget?
Yeah, of the Clinton era. And there's the booming American economy. It's a time of optimism. It's a time of sort of like the cinema is fun. The cinema is not cynical in the way that it's going to become in the post-2000 era. But with that conservative administration, there has to come the answer to it. And there has to come the activism along with it, where like the fight for marriage equality becomes a defining aspect of gay presence in America, in society, in the 21st century. So a sense of queerness associated with activism, gayness associated with activism, gayness as defined by cis, white, male, gay. That is what gay people are. Anything else is the other, and we don't really talk about that. Lesbians, what are those? Bisexuals, they don't exist. And so you have this sense of activism butting up against the compassionate conservative administration of George Bush that wants to ban gay people from getting married. And that is colliding in the movies that we see with this, like, well, there's gay activism. We're pushing, like, gay people deserve rights. Gay people deserve equality. But then at the same time, it is state-sanctioned homophobia, being like, gay people shouldn't get married. There has to be the whole no hate campaign. There's Prop 8. Like, it is an incredible time of activism that I feel like we don't think of in that sense because it's such a popcorn era.
Right.
Like, we don't think of it as like gritty boots on the ground activism in the sense of like the 1970s gay liberation movement. We don't think of it as gritty activism in terms of like the fight to be recognized amidst the plague of AIDS
it's
wiping
not
out a generation
Stonewall,
of gay men.
Like, yeah.
It's not Stonewall. It's not the 90s that have sort of that have that new queer cinema movement running through it, where it's confrontational, it's indie cinema. It's something more mainstream now. It's something more like, you know, pride becoming a corporate event kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think it gets muddled, the fact that there is this vicious tension between progress and people trying to drag rights out of the hands of gay people that is ferociously being fought at this time, while the pop culture is so mass produced and it is so popcorn oriented. And you have a lead into what's going to happen with that fight in this exact era with Bring It On. So it is a nuts time.
Yeah.
And we are entering the celebutante era. Like, boy bands are huge, girl pop stars are huge. There is a monoculture organized around them. And then we start glorifying the celebutante scent.
Right.
And there's a kind of mass cult superficiality that we really prize and treasure that's going to give rise to the Kardashian empire. And we have shows, you know, not just lifestyles of the rich and famous, but from that we have things like Cribs. Like we have an industry that grows around privilege. Shows like My Super Sweet 16. We have an industry that is all about lionizing privilege and how great it is without sort of the critical eye of like, you know, what does privilege mean? What does the implication of this privilege mean with the stratospheric divide between those who have and those who don't have? We weren't having that conversation then. So it's just an anthropological fucking screaming match that you're having at this time. And this movie is right at the threshold of when there's going to be a darkness infused into things, but we're not quite there yet. So there's still the lightness and there's still the fluff to it. And yet at the same time, it's still fag jokes and fat jokes. And it's like, wow, how is all this coexisting at the same time? And I'm having so much fun.
Yeah, I feel like everything that you're saying about like it coexisting, like how difficult it is and how like loaded it is in a specific, like very head to head type of way, like relates back really well to the conversation about like having to represent queer people and like minorities on screen, like imbues you with this very weird sense of responsibility that you shouldn't necessarily have to have, because like you do have to speak for like everyone. You have to fight against like the machine, against the man, to be like, okay, we know that like there are these crazy like difficult things, like, you know, the country is divided in a certain way, and like we have to be the ones to stand up and be like, this is okay. Like we want to be like a light in the darkness. And like you were saying, Jordan of QQ, about like people censoring shit in 2008. It's like, okay, you make a sort of statement in 2000, all of this shit goes down, and then 8 years later it's like obviously progress has been made, but you still have network television censoring the thing that wasn't even that radical 8 years ago.
Well, and George Bush is still president at the time. We're on the threshold of Barack Obama, and whatever balm, real or not, that provides in terms of like the progressive camp
for sure.
and the outlook on the world, but we're still under a presidential administration where, like, I mean, you look at the Trump administration and the rise in xenophobia, the rise in hate crimes, when you have, you know, leadership comes from the, you know, it's top down situation. Yeah. So when you have a leader who sanctions hate, when you have a leader who sanctions violence and says that is okay, you know, it sucks to think that we all like let the tone be set by some asshole in the White House who we're never going to meet. But that does happen. And when you create a climate where hate is safe, it bubbles up in every capacity. And it when it emerges in benign ways that you quote think are quote unquote easy to brush off, then those easy little benign ways of being aggressive against people, those little microaggressions build up to macroaggression.
Absolutely.
And then you have jokes becoming violence, and you have violence becoming death and marginalization. And then you have... you have, you know, a leading structure that's not going to, a leading force in like the White House that's not going to come down on a television network and not going to be, and not going to say these aren't American values. Yeah. They can't, because they're standing for gay people to not be equal, queer people to not be equal with straight people. So like, yeah, USA can be like, you know what? It's kind of the times. And this is still icky and we don't know what to do with it. And when Barack Obama was nominated president in 2008, he was not pro-queer. He was not pro-marriage equality necessarily.
Yes. Yeah.
That had to come around in Obama's second term where he was like, I was wrong. Yes. And he said, he said that I've come a long way. Like, it was made clear that was not the right position to have taken. But a to that point, probably the most progressive president we'd ever elected, a black man, a black Democrat, was elected into the White House. He wasn't so sure how he felt about marriage equality.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the norm of the time. That was where we were at. That to be a progressive presidential candidate who was going to say, yes, we can, who was going to usher in unprecedented change, was still hanging back on that marriage thing. It wasn't sure he felt
and, like,
about
the censorship.
Like, that's how hard the rock being pushed up the hill was and remains.
Yeah, the censorship shit still happens, too. We talked about Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody a couple months ago, and it's like Delta Airlines.
Right, like the airplane.
Yeah,
artists.
Was,
yeah.
like, censoring sex scenes. Like,
sure. Yeah,
what the fuck is up with that? Like, it's still a thing. But, no, go ahead.
No, I think I'm just to steer it back to the movie. I think that, as you had mentioned, like, in terms of representation and, like, what this movie is saying in the characters, we had talked about Power Rangers and how a queer character within that they're asked the question, like, not, they're not even asked a question, but it's like sort of framed as like, are you gay or lesbian or like, what are you? Mm-hmm. And you don't get a straight answer. And it was sort of heralded in the media and everything as like this huge gay movie, where this movie like has a more concrete statement,
like,
on
Marvel
queerness.
With its exclusively gay moments.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
That kind of
Disney.
Bullshit.
Whereas this movie is like really explicitly like wearing it on its sleeve. And it is really all about like the way in which the movie starts and the way like way in which the conversation is held. Like, this movie starts off with that opening scene where you get the tone, you understand like what the movie is going to be saying. It sets up the dialogue that we've talked about, and also like allows you to slip into the queer sort of camp sensibilities of it, which I think is like what allows it to sort of make these more, at the time, like progressive stances, which I love. And I think it's great. And I also, just in terms of masculinity, if we're just gonna like just keep the ball rolling, I think that this movie does. I think that with men in cheerleading, there's always that stereotype of like, if you're a male cheerleader, you're gay. And then they have the whole Fired Up movie, which comes out, where they're like, what if we weaponize being straight and being a cheerleader
to get girls?
Being straight.
Like, the whole pitch is like, what if you were a cheerleader but straight? And so how this movie has like the queer cheerleader with Les, but also like has other straight male cheerleaders, I think is like a fascinating subset, and how it sort of like has that conversation on masculinity and the fragility of it.
It's like being a straight guy in high school theater. Like, you are, if you want to, you can like score more than anyone on
you
the football team.
House.
You
can
are
clean
good.
House.
Key from the prom, right?
Look, like, it's really like, I think that that's a nice inclusion, and like we said, the male cheerleaders, Jan and Les, the fucking boys, like, they're so cool about it. And like, every time those dumbass football players are like, ha ha ha, fuck you, they're always
everyone's
just
like, no,
guys,
fuck you.
You just lost.
Yeah.
You're terrible.
You guys are fucking losers.
Like, you are a skinny twerp, and I will stomp on you like an ant.
It's so good.
Yeah, no, those cheerleaders could absolutely whip those guys' ass.
No question.
And, well, and it just, like, what it, like, the fat jokes never get redeemed.
Oh, no, they don't.
But, like, the like, putting down of the gays, it, like, the people who would do that are the ones who are put in their place.
Yeah.
And they're like the character, the, you know, Sparky Pilastri, when he comes in to choreograph the cheer routine, and he's like, male cheerleaders, enough said. Like, just this castrating comment. He's a con man, and he's been screwing people out of money. We are given like the indicators of who are shitty people. Yeah.
Spirit fingers.
Throughout this
spirit movie. Not jazz hands.
Sorry.
How could
spirit
you?
Spirit fingers.
Sorry.
These are spirit
I'm
fingers.
So sorry. Please continue.
No. And the indicators of these are shitty people are the ones who are delivering the sort of most barbs that are critical of people about their weight or about their sexual orientation. And you have like Courtney and Whitney are assholes, but at the same time, at like to the end point, like Courtney and Whitney realize, you know, Courtney most visibly realizes like the error of her ways, and she has her redemption arc where she's like, second place, hell yeah. And so like it in its way, in the way that 2009 could deliver justice in these ways, it does within the framework of that time in a way that when I watch it now, it still feels satisfying. And I do, and there is like, it's so funny, like the, you know, bringing up the idea of like, how is anybody straight and how do you enjoy things if that's like not what you see and stuff? And, but like, there is the like the girl sense of humor that comes through this, the like, and very gay sense of humor of this movie, like truly like wonderfully gay camp sense of humor that comes through in this movie. The way these characters are mean is fucking hilarious. Like, not every line they say in its demeaning nature is funny, but like the way they joke with each other is funny to me. The way that they're mean to each other is funny to me. Like,
it's
the way
specific.
That they come at Torrance for being like a shitty irresponsible captain is funny to me. And there is an edge about it that just like, You can't get that and feel good about it typically from like when straight dudes make shit.
No.
Like, women can pull it, but it's more comfortably done in like the hands of queer folks. But it's just like, you watch this and it's like, yeah, this is a movie. If I were to go see it at a 20th anniversary screening, it would be with girlfriends and gay friends. Like, that's who would go see this and feel represented by what they're seeing on screen and want to do the line callbacks.
Put the duh and dumb.
Yes.
Exactly. And just, you know, gems like
that. And I mean,
that.
Like, how fun is it to look at this opening sequence written by a woman like Jessica Vendinger and all her, like, snarky glory being like...
The whole, yes. It is Jawbreaker levels, this opening. Yeah. And I still, I thrill at hate us because we're beautiful.
We don't like you either. We're cheerleaders. Yeah.
Leaders. We are cheerleaders. Yeah. It's like, yes, I love mean bitches. Yes. Like, this is awesome.
Would you have been a
give me.
Oh, God. My parents would never have let me, like, within 10 miles of this sport. Are you kidding me?
I just, like.
I even asked because it was the closest thing to dance.
I even asked.
And I, like, I wow. liked dance. I wanted to be involved in, like, something dancey at school. And I was like,
you,
I can do
you much like Missy were trying to compromise by
yes, this is a last resort. My parents were like, absolutely not.
Well,
like,
it's probably best if you were at a small school to avoid the cheerleading groups, because I feel like having been to a small, like going to a small school and then competing against smaller schools on a sports team, seeing the cheerleaders, you're always like, oh, there's like four of you. This is really unfortunate.
I mean, yeah, we didn't have, you know, I went to a very small Catholic school. Like nobody was throwing anybody or doing pyramids. It was just.
The only thing you're throwing up is for Jesus.
Yeah, correct.
One thing, one hopes those crosses, that in, one hopes that in a closed single sex, unit like that within a Catholic institution, that there's a lot of sexual experimentation going on, just because why wouldn't yes. you take advantage of your surroundings? But, you know, who can say for sure?
Right.
I really wish that that was the case. I feel like
like if a bunch of really nuns wish. Are together, what's going to happen?
Like, it was actually like yeah. kind of disappointing.
As nunsploitation has positive.
Exactly. Yes. It's like, we're not even going to repress like a little bit. Like, it was, it's like just not a super straight anyway. Tragic, tragic.
That's unfortunate. What a waste of
time. I know, right? It's okay. I got there eventually. It just took a little longer.
I'm just like thinking in terms of plot. If we have like, because I only have like one other really big thing that I want to call out
you
in terms
go
of the
for
plot,
it.
Which I is don't... I think the ending is transcendent
oh,
in that
yes.
it not
the, I think the ending is transcendent.
Not the ending of the film, the credits, because
it is an all time.
Nothing is better than BTS mixed with a
it's
music
a
video, early end of the 2000s or early 2000s, late 90s, music video, BTS bloopers all in one. That is the chef's kiss of a way to
it
end
is
a movie.
It is a real gold standard
yes.
of the blooper. Of the blooper
when
finale.
Toy Story 2 had bloopers, I was like, oh, this is the peak of cinema, an animated movie with bloopers.
No that's just genius.
But the thing is that Bring It On is like so iconic for this, so much so that I saw that Jordan tweeted about this being like, I wish more movies did this, and someone replied and
was like
oh, the
Bring It On,
and Jordan was like, yes, that was
and
literally
I
what
was
I was
watching that movie. Correct.
No, it, and because like, because it gives you the great, it gives you the combination of the BTS with the value added original materials.
Exactly.
Because there is a whole choreographed routine yes. that goes along with it, where you get to see them just fucking around.
So fun.
And it's adorable.
Yeah, I love
it's
them.
It's adorable. Eliza's like, I mean, her hair's down the whole movie, but Eliza's hair down, mm-hmm. being her Eliza self. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
You really get the sense, like, it, because, like, people came together for the reunion of it, like, it makes me believe that it was, like, a good memory
for
hopefully most
people.
Like,
they had a really
yeah.
good time.
And you just, it really conveys a sense of, like, oh, man, these people had the same kind of fun making this as I had watching it. And that's
which
just
is the
really
best
nice.
Feeling.
It's the best
like,
feeling.
Like, I want that for and Paddington. Like, I want to end bloopers with Paddington. So I'm like, oh, everyone loves the bear.
I mean, it sounds like Hugh Grant knows Paddington's
absolutely.
Like the best thing he's ever
of
made.
Of course, as he should
Notting Hill
be
who?
Correct.
Yeah, it just, you want, you know, you want the things that really stick with you to like have been joyful
yeah.
in their production. And this really seems like it. And it's one of those, like, there is such an innocence to it. Like, we can never go back to that simpler time.
No.
And this movie feels, you know, in the way that we never can in time, but like
time marches on.
Time marches on. It's right. Yeah. It's just in the way that you never can and like you shouldn't, But like, there is such a kind of purity distilled in this movie. It's very warm.
It is.
It's a very warm experience. And to know that like the holistic like experience of it, it has that kind of warmth along with it is really just like, oh, that's fucking great. What a wonderful bonus.
Yeah, and it's so nice to, you know, watch and rewatch for that reason. You know,
I love rewatching this movie. I love rewatch. I like rewatching it probably more than I liked. I loved it at the time, but rewatches of it, I feel like I appreciate so much more of the richness of it. And having a hindsight view on a movie like this, I think makes it better. Like, I think it emphasizes with seeing the ways in which make you kind of like, ooh, and grab your collar. I think it also emphasizes how good the things that work well and still do really were. And just like, God, what a fucking win that was. This movie deserved every bit of that success.
All
and
the
that's
trophies.
Such a wonderful thing to feel affirmed.
Yeah, in. And I mean, like, as we mentioned, this film is...
How much did it make, Brooke?
Really enduring, and it actually, obviously, did extremely well when it came out. This opened on August 25th in the great year of 2000.
Oh, summer movie.
Super wide, 2,300 screens.
If I had seen this, my God, I'm just thinking about my crush I would have had on Kirsten Dunst from this and Spider-Man and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, oof. Of course. Yeah. Like, she was seminal. Like,
transcendent queen.
Yeah.
Amazing. It stayed in the number 5 for 7 weeks. It was number 1 2 weeks in a row with only like an 18%
shit.
Drop. The shit was
that's good.
Banging.
That is insane.
I know. And domestically, it made 68 mil, which adjusted today is
right.
$116 million
fucking
domestic. A. Hot.
On what I would imagine was like, that could have been
million?
That maximum of $20
million.
It's yeah, 10 like, mil. I'm overshooting it on purpose.
Yeah, it was 10 mil?
And apparently,
great. 10
apparently
million.
The most expensive single thing that they spent money on during production was $40,000 to license Cherry Pie during that stripping
I was gonna say,
scene.
It has to be a music yes. license fee. It has to have been music.
It's
yeah.
despicable how much it costs to license music.
It's
it
crazy.
Really makes me, it really grinds my gears, Brooke.
It's so, it's like I recently jumped to a job that is like more adjacent to production. So now I'm like in the meetings where people are like, yeah, it's going to cost $120,000. To license 30 seconds of this obscure song, and you're like, Jesus,
right.
What?
A friend of mine made a movie for Netflix, and the single biggest line item in the budget was the music, because it was a very music like oriented movie, but like he said that over $1 million of the budget went
it's
to music.
It's nuts. It's absolutely crazy.
It was like this, and like. They were like, people were mad at him for it. He was like, we cannot fuck up the music.
No,
in this
well,
movie.
It's like
it's too much a part of what's going on.
It's like
on.
Baby Driver.
So,
it's
like,
so much
yeah,
of the budget for that was just on music because it was like, that's the plot.
It's, yeah. It's crazy. But, you know, we're also happy that this movie did well. A four quadrant hit spawned, as we mentioned, a ton of sequels. Was that the, Jordan off mic mentioned that he
no,
had
no, I have
a game.
I was gonna
oh,
have,
you have a
no,
you
have
a
have
real
the game.
Game
after the
after Letterboxd.
Letterboxd, yes.
Okay.
So whenever you're, if we want to pivot to that,
let's make
it I have
happen.
It and I'm ready.
Because I already, I like put it out there, so I feel like
let's
I need to
it.
Follow through
okay.
now.
You want to do the game now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We all know that Bring It On is set in high school.
Yes.
Am I right?
Mm, it is.
So
yeah.
You're right.
Throughout
you
time,
right.
there have been, you know, high school set films.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to ask you to Bring It On, I will tell you, is in the top 10 of highest growth according to Box Office Mojo. Take this with a grain of Box Office Mojo now sucks salt.
Yeah, it really
it's
does
so sad.
There is a list of the top 10 highest grossing genre high school movies of all time.
Okay, so
Bring
the,
It On is number 9.
The genre is high
the
school
genre. Well, yes, these are all movies that are set in high school.
And is it adjusted for inflation?
I would assume so,
okay.
based on one that is in here.
Noted.
So the 9 that remain of the top 10, I'm going to have you both ping pong. You have 3 strikes and you're out. So if you have a guess that's not in there, it's a strike.
Got you.
And it might be a little tricky.
We've played.
There are some tough ones.
Okay. We've played a variation of this game with a couple of different guests. So I feel like I'm getting a little bit better.
More comfortable.
At it.
Do you
we'll
want to?
See,
would you
we'll
like
see.
To lead off?
I will lead off.
Okay.
And then we can ping pong back.
Brooke
and
Solomon,
forth.
What is your first guess?
Mean Girls.
Mean Girls is in the top 10.
Are you going to tell me what number it is?
I will. It's number 7.
Okay, interesting. Thought it would be higher.
Jordan, the other Jordan, do you have a gander? What would you say is a guess for you?
Does Clueless make it?
In fact, Clueless does not make it.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Brooke Solomon.
Oof, I've suddenly forgotten every high school movie that's ever been made.
Right. As it
there
happens.
Are really a lot, if you just think about it, it makes a lot more sense. It's just like, don't think it's tricky. It's really not that tricky.
The Breakfast Club? Right.
The Breakfast Club is not in the top 10.
Oh my God. All right, Jordan.
10 Things I Hate About
No,
You.
No, not in the top 10.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Not in the top 10. You guys are thinking a little too late.
Okay, so we need some...
You're thinking, I mean...
So we need to think, like...
More modern movies, perhaps?
More modern. Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
So there are some old ones in there, but...
Let's...
Who did we leave off at?
It's your turn.
It's my turn. Okay. It's like a question of, like, what's a high school movie now?
They set in high school.
If it's later,
like set in high school, like it's in a high school. Like there are movies like in this that are like in a high school. It's not necessarily about the high school, but they're in the high school. If that makes sense.
How much did Bring It On make?
68 mil.
68 mil.
I will say I will tell you the budget of the highest grossing one in here made 334 million.
Oh my God! Wait, Spider-Man
Super
Homecoming.
Bad.
Spider-Man Homecoming and Super Bad are both on Super Bad. There we go. Yeah. Now we're cruising.
Okay.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's actually just gonna be movies about a bunch of fucking boys.
Yes. Most of them are.
Yeah, okay. Because teen girl movies don't matter.
Yes. Well, no, they do matter, but to the American public, they don't.
Yeah, to the misogynist American public. Superbad, Spider-Man, that's such a fucking defy.
I know.
Go to hell. That's a Marvel movie. Don't put that in the same
I will say that is the only, just to give you guys so you don't guess, that is the only Marvel and or superhero movie on this list.
Okay. Good. It better be.
Okay.
Because that's, again, that's some trash.
It's a cheat.
Let's see.
Two strikes for you both.
I know. And...
You have 1, 2, 3, 4,
that
like
movie,
five,
did that,
six
that movie,
more to get.
That movie 21 and Over make it?
Ooh, you're very close. Are you sure you don't want to change your guess there?
Right. I think we're on the same page right now.
You can keep... A part of that title, if you want.
Yeah.
What did you just say? 21 and over?
I can tag in for you.
Oh, is it like 21 and under?
No.
21 Jump Street.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll keep that in. There you go. Okay. That's number two.
Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking of the trash one with Miles Teller where they like that it's not super
Project
bad, but
X
it is super bad.
Or whatever.
That's the fucking one. Yeah.
Brooke Solomon.
Okay. So we've got 21 Jump Street.
Your number two. Superbad, your number three.
Okay, so we have the top three because number one
You do
is
have the top three.
Spider-Man Homecoming. Okay.
Spider-Man, Jump Street.
Superbad.
Bring It On's in there. Superbad's in there. So that's four.
Mean Girls is in there.
Mean Girls, yeah.
That's five.
There's
four left.
Oof.
Oh, five left, so it's top
I'm three. Sweating. I'm sweating. I'm thinking.
You're missing a real seminal.
Can you give me a hint?
Two seminal American classics. And I may say
hints?
American is in the title of one of them. I just kind of gave you that movie.
American Pie.
Oh, well, yes. Yes.
Oh.
Jordan, do you have another guess with the keyword American?
With the keyword American? I'm drawing the blanks. So
what is what?
I'll leave it to Brooke if she can come up with a second American.
What do you do when you tag a wall?
American graffiti made the top 10?
Adjusted for inflation, $115 million. That movie made money.
That is actually insane.
Yeah.
I hate that as an entry.
Yeah,
on
that's
list.
Really...
It feels not so, in this, that doesn't feel in the spirit
do you know
of
what,
the list.
That's number four.
Is Weird Science in
with
there?
American Pie is number six. No.
Wait,
I would be so happy if Weird Science
I was like,
was in there.
Okay, so where are we? We have...
I mean, we're both out.
Okay,
at
great.
This point.
She named two. Yeah, she named
out.
Two Americans.
Right,
so that was. We're up to I think seven.
Yeah,
now.
Yes. I think
we're
missing
three.
Okay, I'm gonna say two of these, and you guys are gonna flip.
Okay.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh goddamn.
Oh right, yeah.
Risky Business.
Oh.
And
I would never have guessed.
I wouldn't
that.
Have either.
I think of it's so dissociated for me as a high school.
I agree.
Yeah.
And the last one at number five, Porky's.
Oh, Jesus.
With 105 mil.
Wow. Well,
but you were very close with, so the, I think, I mean, like, the rest of these are kind of classics. You have She's All That, Easy A, Clueless, Project X, Breakfast Club, Napoleon Dynamite, and then John Tucker Must Die.
Oh, a classic. But those are all like 10 to queer, 20, right? Yeah. Yes.
Queer classic, John Tucker Must Die.
Thank you. Absolutely not heteronormative at all.
But also,
John Tucker Must Die, so all of those women can just, so they can live. That is what John Tucker, why John Tucker
it's
Must
Die.
It's
truly incredible.
Who plays John Tucker again?
Jesse Metcalf?
Yes, because Penn Badgley plays his brother.
Yeah, Penn Badgley's the brother.
See, I mean, conflate it, that movie all with I Love You, Beth
Cooper. All we care about is the car kiss. All we care about is the car kiss.
Oh, and the boat sequence. Oh, my God.
Britney Snow and
okay,
Sophia
actually,
Bush.
Oh, my God. Now. You just opened my third eye by saying Britney Snow.
Yeah.
I have always conflated Britney Snow with Hayden Panettiere. So,
Panettiere. Wow. It's Panettiere.
So third when eye we were closed? Talking earlier about Hayden Panettiere.
No. I know her.
Were you thinking of Britney Snow?
No, but I would. Well, growing up, I would always put the two together. Because I feel like they look very similar.
That is absolutely fucking incorrect. Hayden Panettiere is like 4'9".
Hold up.
And looks like a gymnast.
Yeah.
Britney Snow doesn't.
Britney Snow is usually.
Is Britney Snow clueless?
No, that's Alicia Silverstone.
That's Alicia
who's
Silverstone.
Who's the one who died in Clueless? Who's the actress who died who's in Clueless?
Oh my God.
Excuse me. Calm down about it. Let's be respectful of Britney Murphy.
Britney Murphy. Okay. All these white women.
Oh my God, poor Brittany Murphy. Don't do her like that.
I know her pneumonia or mold or murder got to her. Okay, Brittany Snow, now that I'm seeing.
It was a very tragic moment.
Now that I'm seeing photos of Brittany Snow, she's pitch perfect. Yes. Got it.
Yeah, she's pitch perfect. Brittany's, she's pitch perfect. She's prom night.
So who the fuck looks like Hayden that I'm conflating her with?
Kind of nobody. Hayden Panettiere looks like Hayden Panettiere.
I would kind of believe Alicia Silverstone. Hayden Panettiere is very beautiful. She has amazing.
Alicia Silverstone of the iconic downturn mouth and unfuckwithable hair looks like nobody.
It's true.
But Alicia Silverstone.
Yeah.
When she shows up in Batman and Robin.
That's your first touchdown
for
her.
Of course.
I don't even know. I'm surprised.
She's a delightful Batgirl.
I love
her.
She's
a delightful Batgirl.
That she's related to Alfred and Alfred dies. Great. Iconic.
Alfred lives in that movie.
Oh, right. They get the poison or the serum.
Yeah.
Duh.
Alfred lives in that movie. Those movies, the Schumacher Batmans had no stakes. Alfred would never have. They would never have killed.
Oh, wait. You're saying those movies aren't really like edge of your seat, pulse pounding thrillers?
Oh, you.
I love the Schumacher Batman, so you will not hear me impeach.
Masterpieces.
You will not hear me say a word.
We will be covering
Nicole Kidman in Batman Forever.
Dr. Chase Meridian.
Dr. Chase Meridian, when her line delivery of hot entrance when Batman comes in is one of the sexiest line readings of her
I'd
career.
Like to chase her around the Meridian.
Okay.
If you know what I'm saying.
Okay.
All right. Okay, to bring things back a little bit, we're going to jump to the next...
Right. Games Among Us.
The next wrap-up game that we play every episode, which is Jordan guesses the average Letterboxd rating of this movie.
Yes.
You are...
Oh, it's going to be... straight up anti-women.
That's
what
that was my first thought.
You are welcome to put in a guess if you would like to, but it is not required.
But it's, you say it's Letterboxd
rating?
Yes.
So.
Okay, that's different than
exactly. It's not the tomato meter. It's not like
there
the Metacritic.
Is some sway though, because when we were, what movie were we doing where it was gay and all the men were like, oh, we were like reviewing Magic Mike and so many people were just like, oh, this is gay, 2 stars. And you're like, this is a good movie. What are you doing? Anyways, okay. Bring it on. This has a 3.4 Letterboxd average. Lock it in.
Got it.
For me.
Jordan, would you care to hazard a guess?
I'm going to go... I'll give it a bit of a boost for Letterboxd. I'm going to say 5.5. I'll go optimistic.
Oh, sorry. We do the average. So it's usually... It's somewhere between...
It's between one and a five.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking in terms of 10. I was thinking in terms of 10s.
Out of 5.
Yeah, I'll go 4. I'll go optimistic.
Wow. That is very optimistic. I'm sorry to disappoint both of you. The average is a 3.2.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Not below a 3 though.
No.
That's good.
Not below a 3. I appreciate that.
Most
It should be a 4.
It should be higher.
It should be
most
a 4.
Most people give this 3 stars. We both gave it 3.5 personally, I'm pretty sure. So we're doing our part.
Yeah, I would probably give this bad boy a 4.5 if I was rating it on Letterboxd, which I do not have.
Honestly, good for you. Good for you. You don't need it.
Yeah, I have enough. I'm online enough. Exactly. I don't need one more reason. I don't need one more reason. Yes. It's not even like, oh, I hate being on the internet. No, it's just like, don't like, do that don't to yourself. Like,
you'd be a hit on there, though, I got to tell you.
You would.
You would do very well.
I think I would
be
good at the forum. Yeah. I think I would be good at
it's
the forum.
It's basically like tweets, but
maybe,
in review
maybe
format.
That's the thing, is like you drop one and then you sub in one. Like, I'm trying to drop like seven different types of social media. So, but like maybe if you like minus right. here and you can have like a little letterbox on the side, you know, it's like a treat.
Right. You kill LinkedIn.
I have Twitter and IG, and I have TikTok to follow two accounts. And it's the woman who saves bees in Texas.
Love her.
Very iconic.
Love her. And then the account Catherine Wants, which is just a pregnant woman who tells her husband what she wants to eat. And I'm pretty sure he's a professional chef. And he just does like unbelievably entertaining minute long videos where he makes his pregnant wife whatever she wants.
Oh, I have seen a couple of these as well. Wow.
Kind of went around on Twitter a couple times. It's gone around on Twitter a couple times.
TikTok feed right there.
Oh, it's excellent. I made a potato recipe he made on there a while ago this week. Delightful.
If I may suggest one addition potentially in the future.
I mean, I'll entertain it, but it's a real curious.
Oh, I know. That guy that makes intake stream. The guy that makes like wartime recipes from like the 40s and the 50s.
What?
Oh my God, he's amazing.
Is it just beans and bread?
Well, he'll be like, he made a mayonnaise cake because it was like, if you don't have oil and eggs, you like sub in mayonnaise. Right. And he basically like, he follows the recipe, and at the end he like tries it and sees if it's good or not. He's so entertaining.
As a baker, disgusting.
I'm a huge fan. I'm sorry that I don't know his handle because I am not on TikTok, but you know, I rely on Twitter to aggregate TikTok anyway.
And it works great. It's gives curated. Me a good greatest hits. Yes. Yeah. And it means one less social media feed than I need.
Exactly. Well, before we plug all of our various social medias, there is one last thing that we need to do for the quality of the podcast. And it is go around and give our QQ ratings from 1 to 5 stars, add decimals as you will. How queer do we think this movie is? This is a real vote with your heart type situation.
Yeah.
Dance with your heart. Yeah. Cheer with your heart. You know?
Yeah. I usually lead it off with Jordan. Yeah. Do you want to lead it off this time?
Oh, shit. Okay.
Oh, you weren't prepared?
No, I got it. I got it.
Oh, you made a note. You made a note.
Oh, I have too many notes for everything. No, I just wanted to pull up to make sure I didn't miss anything. No, okay. I am going to go in a shock. I think that this is honestly, fuck it. I'm going a 4.
Yeah.
I think that while it has, as we've mentioned, and we've discussed at length the flaws that this movie has in terms of like slurs and stuff like that, I think that it's impossible to look at Les and be like, you're not gay. Like, Les is giving us more. And he is very clearly an out and proud cheerleader. And if this was made today, he would absolutely be just like very, very gay. I mean, unless the new Bring It Ons don't do that, which I don't
we'll
know.
We'll see. Bring It On Halloween. Maybe I'll watch them all. Counting on you.
Right. Yeah. It's all on the shoulders of Bring It On.
It's truly hinging. Our society is at a crux. But no, I just think that this movie is just very loud and queer. And there's just so much subtext to every scene. And there's also text with what people are doing, what people are saying. Yeah. I think it's impossible to also then look at Missy and Torrance and be like, there's really nothing going on there.
Yeah. Wow. Good thing Missy's parents are always out of town.
What a shame that they're in this beautiful mansion all by themselves.
I loved it when we just made things about rich people.
When we didn't critique them, we were like, give me more mansions. But yeah, no, I'm just to keep it slim and trim, baby, this is a 4.
I'd love to hear that. I think that personally, I'm going to go for a 3.5 out of 5.
Wow.
2 stars for Les. Like, you know, the giving softest boy. I love him. He is like very canonically gay. And that is really exciting and honestly like shocking. In a film for this time, especially a sports movie, how fucking yeah. And yes, I mean, come on, 1.5 for everything that a Les Dushku is giving us. There is just like no heterosexual explanation for any of Missy's actions.
No.
Zero.
And we have to support that. Honestly, I do think that this movie has endured incredibly well. And
Very much so.
We said, it does have like amazing rewatch value. And I also would like to say, I asked one of my very good friends, Nicole, who is a like cheerleading pro, like did all of these competitions, all of this stuff.
An expert eyewitness on the case.
Right. I was like, Nicole,
we're covering this movie. I would love to know if you have anything that you would like me to mention from you as a cheerleading pro, since I obviously cannot speak to that. And she said, I only have one thing to say, and that it's, quote, gay as fuck. So I think that we know what the main takeaway is.
That should
from
have been
movie.
The tagline. Right. Bring it on.
Bring it on.
Gay
as fuck.
That comes after Bring It On Halloween.
That's the 2023 iteration.
Sign us, whatever company owns the rights. Paramount? I don't fucking know.
But that's all I have to say. Jordan, what are your thoughts?
I think it's gonna get a 4 from me.
Let's go.
Given its time and place that it came out, and the just like there's almost just like there's hardly anything. It almost feels like the straight aspects of this movie are forced. Like, the heterosexuality of this movie is the only, sexuality-related thing that feels inorganic to it. It's the thing that feels out of place. Everything queer about it feels native to its experience. And it's just sort of, like, bursting out of its circumstantial seams, bursting at its circumstantial scenes for having arrived when it did. But I think this movie is a very good example of, like, I talk a lot about horror, but I think in the context of comedy and at this time, I think this movie is an excellent example of just how much gayness people soak up through their pop culture, completely unawares of the fact that they are osmosising gay humor and sort of gay culture and gay sensibility. I think, like, you know, it's certainly not a perfect movie, and you know, one hopes that entries now do better than Bring It On did in 2000. But I think it's a classic and extremely entertaining example of Trojan horsing the reality of what you want into a movie when the systems that guide you and fund you won't let you come out and be explicit. And for that, it gets a solid 4.
Yeah.
Trojan horsing a lot into this movie.
A lot.
I mean, I only had known the poster and, like, I was sort of aware of what was going on. But, like, watching it, I was like,
there's a lot of play here. Yeah. Oh? It's loaded. Also, love the term Trojan horsing. That is exactly what we like to cover on the pod, is, like, who behind the scenes was making
just the
sure
Trojan horse. We did a whole episode on the Trojan
flowers.
Horse itself.
We
a
did.
Queer icon, the Trojan horse.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a symbol of queerness throughout time.
Absolutely.
In cinema, the Trojan
no
horse.
Cops at Pride, just the Trojan horse.
Exactly. Exactly.
When I become a multi-billionaire and I give away all my money because I hate money, I'm going to buy just one. The one thing for me is going to be a Trojan horse at Pride.
Yeah.
Just a giant fucking recreation of it.
It's going to be good. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, and then a lot of, like, very attractive gym gays are going to pour out of it.
I mean, there's nothing better.
Does that not happen at WeHo every time?
I was going to say, that is
Pride. In battle armor. Right. In battle armor. Right.
Yeah, no, that's Pride 2021.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Vax Girl Summer.
Absolutely.
There it is.
Fucking go.
Vax waxing ready to Trojan horse.
Let's do it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Anyways, Brooke.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan, thank you so much for being here. It was a delight. I'm so glad we got to chat about this.
You brought it on.
Thank you very, very much for having me. I consider myself an amateur anthropologist of this era, and I just have an endlessly fun time talking about it. So thank you guys very much for inviting me.
Absolutely.
We love an expert. We love cultural context in all eras of cinema. So yes, it's amazing. And if people want to hear more from you, as they obviously should, where can they find you?
You can hear so many hours of me talking. It's amazing. I have the weekly podcast with my friend Amanda and producer Jason, Disaster Girls. If you like hearing people talk at length about disaster movies, we're mostly doing it for us and having a lot of fun. Recently endorsed by Tia Carrere, who was the star of the last movie. One
gotta
of the last
love
movies
it.
Ever.
Very fun.
Yeah, love you, Tia Carrere.
I feel like disaster movies are about to make a comeback, weirdly. Like,
I really hope so. We are missing them desperately. We need event disasters.
Well, I mean, like, look, if we're going to look at, no matter quality, Those Who Wish Me Dead, low-key a disaster movie.
Oh, high-key, please.
Right, right. Yeah.
Good or
I
bad,
mean, and Roland Emmerich is back
movie.
At work.
Right.
is back at work on his Moon disaster movie. We need all-star ensemble disaster movies. We need those back. And if you like to hear about the 2000s, I have the Aughts Tyrion podcast with the director Sam Wyman, where we talk about horror movies of the millennium era in the context of if they were Criterion movies. And we sort of give them the Criterion essay treatment, where we talk about the intersection of pop culture and media and at the time those movies were made. And then there's also in the archives A Simple podcast, which is entirely dedicated to the movie A Simple Favor, that does feature interviews from like Paul Feig
Very
and Blake
cool.
Lively, which is extremely thrilling, and you should listen to those. And then upcoming, I have got a single topic podcast about the movie Neon
Demon.
That I hope everybody.
Oh my
well.
God, Jordan!
I'm okay. very fascinated. To
oh, it's gonna
hear
be it's gonna be amazing. It's gonna be because I'm doing it with the journalists and Roxana Haddadi and the journalist artist William O. Tyler, and they have such tremendous insight into the movie. We're having a ton of fun, and we are diving deep on the ceremonial celebration of narcissism, as Nicholas Winding Refn calls it, in Neon Demon.
What a
So those are all the hours of
Nicholas,
talking
such a fascinating person.
Yes, I'm. Oh yeah, there's truly no end. And like, seriously, you are amazing and so delightful to listen to. I was literally
Thank
listening
you.
To Austerian last night while I was making my dinner, enjoying it up.
That is wonderful.
Were you making meat and potatoes from that guy?
No. I was not.
Shocking.
Unfortunately,
you were not making World War II food.
I was making some good fried sautéed veggies.
Beautiful. Very proud of you.
Yes. So please, everyone should check all the various Jordan
please
things
do.
Out.
Yeah, they're all honestly yes.
from one
so,
Jordan.
Definitely.
I will endorse another Jordan.
Thank you.
It's
Thank
important.
You. The Jordans stand.
Thank
we
you.
Have to. We have to at a time like yeah. this.
Who do we have if not
absolutely?
Each other?
Thank you, Jordan Squared. And if you want to find the other two thirds of us, we are mm-hmm. on Twitter mostly. I'm at Brooke B. Solomon.
At Jordan H. Gus.
And we are together at Queer Quadrant. And you can find this podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Please rate, review, subscribe, send us some cheers, send us
no
like,
fears
for sure.
Send you know, D is at reply with gifts of Elijah Dushku in various
Please.
Ways because that's always a,
I
that's
welcome
always
it.
All on board.
I would love it. It would be incredible. And if you want to stick around next week for a completely different change of pace, we are talking the seminal gay classic
here, baby.
Film Heat.
I'm very excited.
Wow, that is a pick. Yes. That's a great spectrum.
We love,
so
that's
excited.
We love variety. We are actually, by the time this episode releases, we'll be in the middle of Pride Month. And we were like, well, we don't need to do anything special for Pride Month. Every month is Pride Month on the podcast. So as you will have heard at the beginning of this episode, we're highlighting different organizations that, you know, we want to like bring light to, that we want to donate to during Pride. But we somehow ended up with absolutely the most insanely
lineup.
Like random collection of movies during Pride Month.
I would say Heat is
a
probably
lot of
viewed
swings.
As the most queer film ever made, right?
I mean, well, you know,
right?
Let's save it for next week, but honestly, I'm kind of stoked.
Hoo-ah.
So stick around for
a lot
that.
Of impressions.
Yes.
It's going to be a mess. A
lot of impressions.
So many.
And Brooke, do you have anything that you would like to leave our audience with?
In fact, I do. Okay. Awesome. Oh, wow. Like, totally freaked me out. I mean, come on. Our podcast sure is number one.
Wow.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you.